Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
In the good old summer.
Hello, all theater lovers, both out and proud and on the DL, and welcome back to Broadway Breakdown, a podcast discussing the history and legacy of American theater's most exclusive address, Broadway. This series is called The Big Move, and it is covering shows that had such success off-Broadway that they just had to transfer and try their luck on the Great White Way. My guest today is an alum of the pod, friend of the pod, former podcast host himself, and has decided that he's too good for the podcasting world, except for when I blackmail him into coming on to here. Please welcome back our good Judy, James Crichton.
Hi.
Hi. James, this is our first time recording in person in 3 years.
Yeah.
Craziness.
And we have really, this is quite a glow up.
It is quite the glow up. Well, you're just talking about my face and body, but also the studio in which we are in.
Yes. Gorgeous.
Beautiful studio. One of Daddy Milliron, yes. There is video component for this episode. How much of it will get released, who's to say? But I'm sure that some of it will come out for promos. BPN is very big on me having video content for them. And I'm like, I'm busy and I have a face for podcasts. James.
Yes.
Last time you were on, we talked about a play. It was The History Boys. And we're talking about another play today.
Mm-hmm.
What play are we talking about today?
We are talking about Love, Valor, Compassion.
Not Love,
Valor. By Terrence, the late, great Terrence McNally.
Four-time Tony winner, Terrence McNally. This is one of his Tony wins, his second Tony win, actually, his first for play. He is up there with Tony Kushner as a playwright who won back-to-back Tonys for Best Play. This and the Masterclass was the following year. He had a good 94 to 96.
Yeah, I mean, this whole era, I just feel like this early 90s era of theater making was so exciting.
Yeah.
I was thinking about that while we were, well, you can get into it, but we were watching it today, and I was just thinking about, like, the scope of what people were watching in the early 90s is fascinating to me.
Yeah, there was a time with Broadway when it was, like, very anemic, right? Like, the 80s, everyone talks about how, like, you couldn't get arrested on Broadway. Like, it was, unless you were one of the mega musicals, it was really hard to break through. And then the 90s was the beginning of sort of an optimistic turning point. And it took a minute. And it really kind of started with plays and revivals of musicals and then got more so with original musicals.
Mm-hmm.
But also it's easy for us to look back at the time and be like, oh my God, 1991 Tony Awards, we have Secret Garden and Miss Saigon and Once on This Island and Will Rogers Follies. Like, what a lineup. But at the time, everyone was like, I don't know. It's not the best lineup.
Yeah.
It's you don't know what you got until it's gone. But... yeah, like there's the plays of the 90s, especially the first half of the 90s. We have both Angels in America's, this Masterclass, so many other interesting ones and ones that like no one really talks about anymore. Like the season of Love, Valor, of Love, Sasha, Valor, Compassion. This was up against the play Indiscretions.
Oh.
Starring Jude Law, Kathleen Turner, Cynthia Nixon, Roger Rees. And Eileen Atkins.
Wow.
Yeah. It was like trying to be sexy, but also classy. I don't know much about it. It's like a lot of love affairs. It was like aspects of love meets Closer is how I.
Very interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. And then Having Our Say, which was based off of a book that I know nothing about. And then what was the fourth one?
I don't know.
Well, I'm looking this up because I'm good at my job.
Yeah, well, I'm very curious. This is something that I don't have a tremendous amount of.
Arcadia by Tom Stoppard.
I don't know.
Yeah. Which is not... that was one... so, okay. I would imagine at the beginning of this season, because Arcadia... and I know this because of the Carousel connection. Arcadia went into the Beaumont after Carousel at Lincoln Center Theater. And was very much like, it's the next Tom Stoppard. And was transferring from London. And everyone's like, oh, this is going to be like the big thing. Yeah, it's going to be like the big play of the year. And Love, Valor, Compassion came out off-Broadway with Manhattan Theater Club at their underground theater where For you musical theater freaks out there, that's where the Julia Marnie Wild Party was. For anyone who's actually living in the city and goes to see plays, it's where Prayer for the French Republic just was. It's underground at City Center. And I'm not sure like what the buzz on it was originally, because he was a respected writer, you
Right.
know, but I don't think he'd had a play on Broadway in a while. His last Broadway work was Kiss of the Spider-Woman, I'm pretty sure.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and that kind of revived him as in his career as like being prestigious again, because there was a period in the late 80s, early 90s where just like everything he did, except for maybe like Frankie and Johnny and the Clair de Lune, just wasn't really like
Hitting.
it wasn't hitting, wasn't landing. And I feel like the early 90s was sort of a revival for him, and starting with Spider-Woman and then into this. And I mean, in a way, like with Nathan Lane and Steven Spinella, those were probably like the biggest theater names in that cast at the time. Spinella was just coming off of Angels.
Angels.
And Joe, this was technically the second thing Joe Mantello
Okay.
directed in New York. He had a play starring Faith Prince called What's Wrong with This Picture? And if you want to know what that was like, just know that the poster is up at Joe Allen.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
See, I don't, I feel like 100 years ago, I watched this amazing YouTube series or like a YouTube video of like a roundtable discussion with Terrence McNally, Joe Mantello, and all of these people that were shaping, Lynn Meadow. I think it was everybody that was sort of involved. And I remember them sort of saying that, like, I forget exactly what the story was, maybe you know, but something happened with Terrence McNally and Joe Mantello, and he was kind of like, something clicked, and I knew he was the only person who could like stage this. And what a choice.
Well, Joe's career is interesting because he was an actor, an aspiring director, and he made his Broadway debut at like 30, 31 as Lewis in Angels in America. And I remember when Steven Spinella won, I say remember like I was watching it when it aired, but I've watched,
Tons of research.
well, I don't know. I'm that stupid
Same,
idiot who go, well, I love to watch the old Tony ceremonies.
of course.
I also miss the Tony
Doing
ceremony
plays.
doing plays, and also like that took place in a Broadway theater
Yeah.
when it was, you had 1600 seats, so it was just the community. It was not anyone who wanted to buy a ticket. So you really got a sense of what the community was behind and who they were behind based off of like who won and what won. So like I'll never forget watching the 1990 Tonys and Tyne Daly wins for Gypsy, and just like every gay in the mezzanine is losing their shit.
Yeah.
And that is how you know that like her performance was beloved even then.
Yeah.
And so when like Angels swept its first year, like, you know, the audience is going insane. And Spinella wins for featured actor, and he would win again the following year for lead. But for featured, he makes a very big point to thank Joe, because that's, and especially in part one, the prior Lewis relationship, like one does not work without the other. And he describes Mantello as like a brilliant director. And I don't think any, first of all, no one in New York knew who Mantello was until Angels came out anyway. And he was an actor for that. So for Spinella to like in his
Say
speech be
that.
like say like he's a director and a brilliant one, it's like, oh, I'm sure there were some people in the room being like, huh, maybe I do want one of like the actors from the hottest show in town to direct my reading and this other thing. And I don't know exactly how his directing career in New York launched from there, but in terms of like mainstream, what I can find on like IBDb and whatnot, when he and Spinella left Angels, he directed this Broadway play with Faith Prince around the same time he was directing the off-Broadway production of Love, Valor, Compassion. And as the Faith Prince production bombed that December, Love, Valor, Compassion blew up off-Broadway. So I think it's very fortunate
The
of that timing,
balance.
yeah, because Broadway's got a short memory, and like you're only as good as the last thing you did. I don't know how we got to this, but
Joe.
Joe, it's all about the Joe. Oh, but yeah, so he was not like a named director, and Spinella and Nathan were like the two biggest names in the cast. So I think like maybe there might have been buzz from that, but I don't think this was like expected to be anything, or if it was, it would, you know, be a successful run and that would be it. But it moved to Broadway almost immediately. Like within, it's a Heidi Chronicles Hamilton kind of turnover, where it was like it closed beginning of January and then like started previews at the end of that month on
Yeah.
Broadway.
Well, I know we keep trying to probably like move on, but like
Why, stop acting brand new. You've been on this podcast before. There's structure has gone out the window along with my sanity and my tolerance for anyone's bullshit. Go right ahead,
True.
cheese.
Well, what I was gonna say is it's so interesting to me. Like, I think, I was born in the early 90s and I am still watching it. We can discuss our journeys, what led us to here, but I read the play a few years ago after I saw The Inheritance on Broadway. And then in the pandemic, I had like a reading of it with a couple of friends and just like on Zoom, and it was wonderful. And then I trusted sort of my two readings of it and then watched it today with you.
Yes, we went to the Lincoln Center Library and watched it.
Next to each other and side by side monitors.
It was very hot.
And also a little hot, but then it got cold at the end.
God.
But we watched this today and I was so, we'll get there. But what I was gonna say is I was blown away sitting there watching it, just being like, when I think of the early 90s, I know where we are today as a theater community. And you,
Yeah.
although you do mention like Tiny Lily, the gays like rising and cheering, but like just thinking about the appetite for non-theater people, like in the New York City business people, people, tourists, it's fascinating to me that there is this slew of very gay plays that are sort of winning all the top awards and are the hottest plays like in the city. It's just I guess it struck me in watching Joe Mantello's staging of the play that it was very contemporary and it felt very modern. And I was just amazed that that was happening off Broadway in 1994.
Yeah, it's we'll talk as we talk about the play itself and the production that we watched, which Terrence himself says in the notes for the script he considers to be definitive, that production. And I think he's not wrong when you think about that the play was successful. It ran, maybe not like for years and years, but it ran for about 7, 8 months, recouped its investment very quickly, and I'll talk about that as well for a little bit. Won Best Play, had a movie version with the majority of the original
Right.
cast, also directed by Joe, but it hasn't come back to Broadway or off Broadway in any way. And Terrence has had other works come back, masterclasses come back. Frankie and Johnny's had
Yeah.
two Broadway revivals. He had that one play, It's Only a Play, that
Right.
no one really liked but did well because of Nathan and Matthew. And this has not. And I think it's partly because it's a product of its time, but also because that. No, I'm going to say that. Product of its time, not just in terms of what it's about, but how it approaches what it's about. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to be condescending to it, just there's a lot about everything that's made in theater, right, is essentially a time capsule of the time that it's made in, based off of how it approaches subject matter, how it's written, things like that. And some works magically can stay evergreen just by some weird kind of kismet. And having certain creatives over the years come back to it and like have an amazing approach. Not always, and sometimes it does take like the right person to come back to it 30 years later to find the right way into it. You know, I always say with Carousel, Carousel was considered dead in the water until Nick Heitner was like, actually, this is kind of Tennessee Williams set to music, which was the perfect approach. Everyone thought South Pacific was dead in the water till Bartlett Sher was like, I think this is a good script. What if we got actors? And everyone's like, oh shit. Or like Boeing Boeing was considered like this huge flop in the 60s, and Matthew Warchus was like, what if we just leaned into how ridiculous it was? And what if I brought in Mark Rylance? And we're like, abso-fucking-lutely. So maybe it's just taking the next Joe Mantello to come along and like give this energy, but this is also one of the, for lack of a nicer term, one of the AIDS plays. AIDS plays. In the fact, and I wrote this down in my notes where it's like, yet again, an early 90s, late 80s play where like AIDS is the thing. It's like, it's the big elephant in the room, and it's the thing that makes the play pivot from comedy to serious. And it's all about that. And it's so easy in 2023 now to look at that and be like, God, yeah, no, we get it. But we were still very much in the thick of it. It had gotten better, but it hadn't gotten much better. Like, it was not necessarily a death sentence anymore, but also like there was no cure. And it took like a decade of fighting to even get to that point. So there was still a lot of anger and a lot of exhaustion. And you can definitely see that with Nathan Lane's performance in the play. It's more for me when like Stephen Spinella as Perry or John Glover as, I guess, James, when he's playing James, where it's like it becomes sort of like the, and now I am Laura Linney and this is Masterpiece Theater. And we will now talk about the thing. And you know it's important because I'm speaking in a monotone. And that's where I'm like, oh, yeah, this is early 90s attitude of this. You know, like, whereas Larry Kramer with The Normal Heart, written like literally in the thick of it, of the Rise Up movement, is like, that play is nothing but anger. And Angels in America is anger with humor attached, and Love, Valor, Compassion is mostly humor with sadness attached. And then I feel like once we get to the end of the 90s, it just becomes like sad. And then all of our gay plays for the early 2000s are just sad.
Yeah.
And we're still kind of sad. Like, speaking of The Inheritance, so much Weekend in the Country stuff, The Inheritance loves to make you sad. It really is like us gays, man.
It made me very sad.
Yeah. We don't have to talk about The Inheritance.
We won't. But yeah,
speaking of an ensemble of gays.
Great.
Yeah.
It's interesting just to track, like, you know, and I know that there was another, I forget, is it a Terrence McNally play that Second Stage did? There's a second play that I'm trying to think about that I'm forgetting off the top of my head, but there's another one that I had wanted to read. But there's this, yeah, there's a lot of plays about gay men identifying with each other. But I think the other reason that it feels dated,
mm-hmm,
it's a lack of representation.
Well, yeah, so.
And we, you know, that was very apparent today watching it.
Yes.
As well. It's a bunch of affluent white men mostly.
Yes. So, oh, James, this is one of my favorite topics to talk about.
Hit me with it.
Well, I talked about this in the Heidi Chronicles episode with our other dear guest, Jessie Field, who is, she would describe herself as well as, you know, very out and proud lesbianic playwright and lyricist. And yeah, she and I get along like fucking, you know, Compton and Green. But we were kind of talking about this. I think it was Heidi Chronicles. And I don't know why specifically, other than the fact that we're both gay, because it had nothing to do with the play. But the queer community is so fascinating to me, especially the queer community in the arts, because we mostly, our initial reaction now to works about us in the 80s and 90s was like, oh my god, gobble it up, like, we're gonna show up in droves, we want this thing to be successful, and even if it's not very good, like, we're gonna show up for it, we're gonna make sure that it, you know, runs, and it's gonna win that fucking Tony, and we're gonna cheer when Terrence wins that award, which was also like a major career thing for him as well. He'd been around for so long, and that was his first win for best play, and everyone was like, he did it. But now, especially with our younger friends, our younger benders, as I would call them, it's because we've had quite a bit of representation now in many different mediums, which I'm grateful for. Now it's about whether it accurately reflects your personal story. And if it doesn't, then garbage mama, cancel, set fire to it. And it takes all of us as a community, like a solid 3 or 4 years until the thing comes out, to then look at it as a piece of the tapestry of our representation. You know, like when... these are bad examples because I don't think all these things are good, but like, just, I remember when Love, Simon came out, or Call Me By Your Name came out, and Call Me By Your Name is beautiful, but still, a lot of backlash was mostly just like, that's not what it's like to be gay. I'm like, that's not what it's like to be gay for you. And it doesn't have to represent your story to still be worthwhile. Of course, then the frustration is more like, well, we keep on having like 5 stories a year, and 4 out of the 5 are about affluent, prominent gay men with beautiful homes and whatnot. And
homes in the country.
Yeah, and like, and most of them aren't very good anyway. Like, I don't know if you saw any of the Uncoupling series that Neil Patrick Harris did for Netflix recently.
No.
Trixie and Katya did a We Like to Watch with it. That was more interesting than the show itself. Basically, Neil Patrick Harris and Tuck Watkins break up after like 25 years of being together. They're the Perry Arthur couple.
Uh-huh.
Or rather say Tuck Watkins breaks up with Neil Patrick Harris. You know, Patrick Harris is like, I haven't been gay single since the 90s. What do I do? And so he has to like learn about Grindr and all this stuff and stony things. But like, they're all, him and all of his friends, very wealthy, very successful, like beautiful homes, all this stuff. And it's, that's all fine. I consider that like my Nancy Meyers movie porn with your beautiful kitchen. But they also like tried to make it like, we're just like everyone else. We also have issues in the way of love. I'm like, yes, but also just allow yourself to be real estate porn as well. Like, acknowledge the fact that so much of your life is easy, and you can, and like, and the problems you have, while like, yes, we all can connect to them, do not act like it's the Hindenburg. We all go through emotions. They're all real. And also, like, all the relationship stuff that Neil Patrick Harris Harris deals with after he uncouples from Tuck Watkins is like, oh, this guy I'm trying to hook up with is too big. Oh, this other guy who I'm starting to date, I don't know, he gets along with my friends too well. And it's kind of creepy. It's like things where I'm like, that's not, that's sitcom stuff. And you're trying to make a statement.
Hmm.
And yeah.
I need to watch this.
No, you don't.
I think I do.
Just watch Trixie and Katya watching it. That's more worth it. Well, also on that note, sitcom making a statement. Are you familiar with Torch Song Trilogy?
Yes, okay. Very much so.
So I did go to, that was the last time I went to the library, was to watch Torch Song.
The original.
Yeah, the original, like the 4-hour version.
The one that was like off Broadway.
Yes, they filmed it when it was at the Actors Playhouse, because that was another one that had a very quick turnaround. They were there for like 4 months and then moved to Broadway like that July.
Okay.
And they filmed it at the Actors Playhouse because Matthew Broderick wasn't going to transfer with it to Broadway. He was going to do a movie. And the producers really wanted Matthew's performance preserved.
Oh, yeah.
And Harvey talks about this in his book.
Yeah, I was going to say, I read this in the book.
Yeah, he's like, I was dealing with a virus with my throat. So he like, and you can tell when you're watching, you're like, oh, geez, is he going to make it through the performance?
Oh, wow.
He does, but still. But yeah, it's the whole 4-hour thing. Porch Song is interesting because it is a bit sitcom-y, or at least Act 3 is very sitcom-y, but also like, has a very powerful statement to make, and they do it in a really good way because they don't punish you with the statements they're making. They come from a very real emotional place, and your guard is down because you've been laughing for the last hour, and it's not like, gotcha, why were you laughing, but rather like, no, behind all the jokes, like, I am in pain. And that is beautiful, as opposed to something like Uncoupling, where Neil Patrick Harris is like, I look like Neil Patrick Harris in my $5 million apartment, and I can't catch a break. I don't know. Maybe I just have
now
something
I really
against,
want to watch it.
Maybe I have something against Neil. I don't know. He was a good watch this face. I was gonna say John Benjamin Hickey, but that's Love, Valor, Compassion. In Assassins. What's his name? The one who shoots Kennedy.
Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yes. Yeah. What is wrong with me?
Yeah, it's like
I knew it was I'm fucking dumb. I can name
famously. I can't remember any of the names in Assassins and who does what, but that came to me.
Yes. Yes. Well, Sarah Jane
Moore.
Yes. She's the KFC bucket. And then Squeaky Frome.
Frome.
Yeah. She's unworthy of the love.
Right.
The only connection we have of this to the
Joe player, Mantello.
Joe Mantello. The connection. There we go. So back to Love, Valor, Compassion.
Yeah.
No, you were going to say something.
No, but it's, again, it's tangential. But I was just going to say, like, about Joe Mantello, it's so interesting that he, in a way, his directing this play with so much music, and the use of music is so big throughout it.
And dance.
It's fascinating to me that, because I think it was A Man of No Importance before Wicked?
Yes. It was, God, I'm such a freak. Man of No Importance was the spring
same
of 2003.
Right?
No.
Oh.
It's spring of 2003. Wicked went out of town summer of 2003. So he was.
And then came back Halloween.
Yes, because I also know this. Michelle Federer, who played Nessa Rose, was in the ensemble of Man of No Importance.
No.
And I'm convinced she got Nessa Rose, not just because she was wonderful, but because she also had the working relationship with Joe.
Oh, my God.
So when she went in for it, he was like, oh, she's a wonderful actress. She's understudying Sally in Man of No Importance. Let's have her play Nessa Rose.
I did not know that.
Mm-hmm. Well, she also went to Stage Door Manor, and I remember when I was there, she came to, like, do a Q&A and talked about that audition process.
And it's important when you're like in one of those programs, you know the history.
Yeah, yeah.
And everybody's resumes. No, but like, I just think it's like, what a blueprint of like this play and then other plays. Mm-hmm. Angels in America is so enormous in its scope, not that he directed it, but just being in it.
Yeah.
And directing.
Well, and he has said he did a conversation with George C. Wolfe, and he was like, I learned so much from you. He's like, I always like kind of adhere to you when I'm directing.
Well, the best learns from the best. But it's
absolutely.
But it's this thing, it's amazing then that like A Man of No Importance, again, very small musical, mm-hmm. leads the way to Wicked, which is this huge world.
Yeah.
And then we go into like Assassins. And then that could probably Take Me Out. Like, I feel like there's so much.
Yeah. So I think Take Me Out.
It's all happening around.
Yeah. Take Me Out was the same season as Man of No Importance, because Take Me Out was another off-Broadway to Broadway transfer. There was a period in the early 2000s where, like, Joe Mantello was just knocking him out with his big old dick. And it, like,
amazing work.
Just drop and trowel and be like, and what of it? And Take Me Out was his first Tony for Best Director of a Play.
And then the next year,
he wins Best Director of a Musical for Assassins. Yeah. At least I'm pretty sure that's the order. Yeah, because Assassins is Dennis O'Hare. He could not have been in the same shows at the same time. Yeah, it was Take Me Out, Director of a Play the previous year, and then Assassins the following year, same, and Assassins was the same season as Wicked. So base and Assassins was supposed to be in 2001, and then they canceled it because
Right.
of 9/11.
That I remember reading
Yes.
about as
And
the
so
time passed.
yes, and then they pushed it back 2 years. So like he went from Take Me Out off Broadway, transferring to Broadway to Man of No Importance, which was supposed to transfer. Like that was not like there were contracts signed, but it was one of those things with that creative team, Roger Rees, how like everyone was like, sure, Broadway's coming. Miss Sally Murphy, If You're Nasty. So like of course it was like everyone's like, we're waiting, we're waiting. Sally's gonna get that Tony nom one day. And that didn't happen. And he went right into Wicked. Well, he had been doing Wicked, but Wicked was right after that, which as I understand he hated. He hated that whole experience.
Really?
Oh yeah. I'm not really spilling tea here. Joe is an actor's director, right? It's like it's having the chance to work with the actors and like really shaping the story. And you know, directors should be collaborative, but also you are steering the ship. And when you are being undermined by others, it's no longer a collaboration. And basically what happened was out of town, it was a real power struggle between him and the writers. And the show that Joe wanted is not the show that we got. The show that Joe wanted was a little closer to the book, a little weirder, a little more human based. There, Stephen Schwartz talks about this whole thing with Wicked of like, they had this whole funeral scene for Dr. Dillamond in out of town. Because Dillamond also like does die in the book and like for realsies, not for play like he does in the musical.
Wow.
And there's a whole thing about the funeral and how Elphaba sings at the funeral. And so they made that happen in the stage show originally. The stage show was a lot weirder and darker. And out of town, you know, it was a bit of a mess. And they were like trying to streamline it. Like the show is running 3+ hours. We gotta cut it down. And he kept like one of the major things they wanted to cut was the funeral sequence. And Joe Mantello kept saying no. And finally, they were just like, Joe, why do you want to cut it? And he's like, it's the first time Elphaba wears black. Until then, she's always wearing other colors. And it, like, it's a sign of why Dr. Dillamond matters to her and the respect she has from him. Like, she
No
only,
chills.
yeah, I just had it too. She's like, that, like, she will wear black for the rest of the time now that he's dead. Like, it's her way of like connecting with what's important to her and her fight for like the animal rights and whatnot. And Stephen Schwartz and Winnie Holzman heard that. And their response was, no one gives a flying fuck why she's wearing black. She just has to be wearing black at some point. And to their credit, they were right because people are stupid. But Joe Mantello was also beautifully right, artistically speaking. And when that moment happened, I was like, okay, they like Winnie Holzman and Stephen Schwartz basically locked themselves up for 3 months after Out of Town, did their changes to the show, wrote Dancing Through Life and all the other things. And now it's the Wicked that we all know and some of us love. Or and some of us love some of it. But that like that is why that show is not like a great experience for him. But the beauty of that is he was able to channel all that probably channel all that frustration into Assassins, which was his second Tony, and which he does a gorgeous job with. My God.
My God,
He's
we should change the title of this episode.
to just Joe Mantello. Joe Mantello, please come and sit with us.
I mean, he's absolutely one of my idols, but we can move on.
My two favorite working directors on Broadway right now are Joe and George C. Wolfe.
Of
Yeah.
course.
I would add Nick Heidner, but he hasn't done anything on Broadway since One Man, Two Governors. He keeps on just staying in London like the goddamn Brit that he is.
Really, I beg to differ with you.
How do you mean?
You're the top.
Yeah.
You're an arrow collar.
Yeah.
You're the top. You're a Coolidge dollar.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFF's creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFF's The Original New Musical from Shayna Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
But so, compassion,
Right,
Jesus.
please let's go
Wait,
back to
so
the
how did
play.
you first know about this play? How did it come into your life?
I think I've always, musicals were my way in.
Yeah.
Always. And so for me, I think I was a big fan of, as a kid, I loved Ragtime.
Mm-hmm.
I loved So the Spider-Woman. Like, I loved all the musicals that he had a part of or part in.
Listen, this is why you and I are cut from the same cloth. Spencer Glass as well. Hi, Spencer. We talked about this when he was on the pod many years ago. Like, we all wanted to play Melina in Kiss of the Spider-Woman.
Well,
At the age of 11.
But, like, beyond that, for me, what it's always been about, and my students at the theater camp that I teach at USDAN, like, they are all, I don't know if some of them just say it because they're being nice, but, like, I always try to direct the show that, like, the composers were not, maybe wasn't their most successful attempt commercially.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I did Allegro a few years ago for Rodgers and Hammerstein. I did, like, I really want to do Dear World. Like, I want to do, like, weird shows.
You are Buzz, yeah.
I did Anyone Can Whistle.
Okay. That's less weird.
I love Anyone Can Whistle. But regardless, so I always sort of look down the path of where can I look? And so with Terrence McNally, that led to, you know, studying his plays and watching those amazing clips of Audra McDonald and Master. Like, do you know, just all of those, it just opened my world to him. And so this came probably I was actually very strange, and much to Ali Gordon's chagrin, I only saw Angels in America, the HBO version, 3 years maybe after I graduated college. And I think I read Love, Valor, Compassion shortly after that. I never had read it in college.
Wait, why are we bringing up Ali Gordon?
Because she loves Angels in America.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, yes.
It's her favorite show.
That and Amadeus are why she and I became friends in high school, because we were the only kids our age who were like, Angels! So Angels 3 years after...
Angels in America.
Yeah, 3 years after college, and then...
Yeah, Lockout, because but... I never, for some reason... And I had two different college experiences in play analysis classes, and neither focused on Angels in America. So yeah, I didn't read it until...
We didn't do anything on Angels when I was in college either. Honestly, I feel like it's just such a huge piece.
It's
like,
huge.
That's something you gotta, like, spend a semester
on. Well, but interestingly enough, my brother, who's in finance... and is 5 years younger than me, went to Villanova, and he took a philosophy class, and they tackled Angels in America for months.
As well they should.
They read the script. They talked about the play. They, like, watched the HBO version. Yeah. I was like, what? We didn't do any of that.
Well, when you're going to theater school, and you got to cover all the theater.
There's a lot,
like,
to do.
It's like, yeah, we can't spend 4 months on Angels. Come on.
We have a lot to do.
Yeah, like, Language of the Stage, we talked about it. We definitely talked. I remember we talked about it. But, yeah, I think Courtney O'Connor was like, yeah, we're not covering Angels, because that's going to take us... most of the semester. She's like, we've got seven plays to get through.
But it's what led me to Love, Valor, Compassion.
Yes. There is a whole slew of gay works out there that all of them are important and worthwhile in some way, even if not all of them hold up, if some of them are half good or not even very good. I mean, I would say, you know, we have to look at Torch Song Trilogy. We have to look at 5th of July, Boys in the Band, Angels in America, The Normal Heart, Love, Valor, Compassion, Jeffrey, The Inheritance, Choir Boy, God, what are some others I'm not thinking of right now?
I know, now I'm trying to think.
Yeah, trying to think of all the gays.
You got a really big, you got the right ones, though. Yeah. I feel like you got, like...
Well, a big one that we will be discussing later on this series is going to be Significant Other.
Oh.
Which is not epic in terms of size, like Angels. It does not cover AIDS like half of these plays. But I think at this moment, it is probably the best representation of... being a millennial gay. It's just, there are some truths about that play that, like, still make me cry just thinking about.
I left and sobbed into the street when I saw.
I can't talk about it too much just because I want to save it for that episode. But yeah, I saw it off Broadway with my best friend, cried, and then saw it on Broadway a year later and had to run out of the... I remember they were collecting for Broadway Cares, and I, like, pushed Rebecca Naomi Jones out of the way because I was sobbing so hard. I was like, no, I cannot. But I also remember intermission of Significant Other, and I'll tell the story again for that episode. But my best friend was on the other side of the theater, and so I was sitting next to two random straight girls. And the way that Act 1 ends... Do you remember how Act 1 ends with Significant Other at the bachelorette party?
Yes.
Act 1 ends, and the two girls next to me are like, oh my God, this play is so hilarious. And I turned to them and I went, this play is devastating.
Yeah, it freaked me out.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, you're right.
Yeah. But God, I lost the plot so many times already. I had so much I wanted to say and I didn't. Love, Out of Compassion.
Yeah, go back.
Yeah, Love, Out of Compassion. I don't even know anymore. Love, Out of Compassion. What's it about? Who's she about? What's her life? What's her story? What's the plot of love, Velour, Compassion?
Well, the thing that's also struck me that was interesting today in watching it is that it feels very much. I recently read a book called Our Country Friends by Gary Steingart, which he actually wrote during the pandemic, and it is about the pandemic and like a home in the country.
Yeah.
And it feels, Love, Valor, Compassion feels so Chekhovian, sort of like in its scope. Like you're kind of waiting to try to figure out like what's the turn. But it's all moving so quickly that it almost feels. I think the other reason that I felt that it, what is it about, is it's kind of just about friendship. And I think how friendship can be. I feel like I'm winding because I think it's about a lot of different things, but it's also about nothing. And it's.
Yeah, it's well, yeah, it's about queer relationships and
Yes.
friendships. Yeah, the basic premise is eight gay men over one summer at the country home of one of them, and sort of what goes down. There's like one major inciting incident that it does, but the thing is, like, it doesn't even do anything, that major incident. It's like, and that's something that I feel like the play kind of, I can't tell if the play thinks that that incident does something, or if it's tricking you into thinking that it's going to do something, because it ultimately doesn't do much.
I feel like it might be the latter.
That it's tricking you.
Yeah.
I would hope so. I would hope that Terrence was smart enough about that. Basically, so it's when the play begins, there are three couples. There's Arthur and Perry, the 14-year together, not legally married but technically married. They wear their wedding rings, and they're the most like.
Have a beautiful apartment together in life.
The mo they are the couples that when queer people were fighting for marriage rights kept being like, we're just like you, look at our two gays
Like,
here.
no, you're
Yeah,
not.
like but like they are the ones that are most easily swallowable to straight
Straight,
queer. Yeah,
yeah.
like one's a lawyer, one's an accountant. They never wear short shorts.
But like their suspenders are on, white
Yes,
button-down shirts.
they're relatively, Arthur is more straight passing than Perry is, but Perry's not over the top. Then we have Gregory and Bobby, which is a May December romance. Been together for 4 years. Gregory is a dancer, a choreographer, supposedly very successful, has his own company, very well known in the dance world, successful enough to own this country home, this
With like a
giant,
beautiful studio.
yeah, beautiful studio off of the lake. I think we're meant to believe that he's sort of like the white elephant Illy. That's what I'm gathering, because he's not from like the ballet modern dance world. He's not Broadway, and Bobby is his much younger
Partner,
boyfriend,
yeah.
partner boyfriend, who is blind, and they make a point of that in the play of, what does it say about a man that he chooses a partner who can never see his work, but I think, I don't know if that's meant to be a statement or not. And then John, who's a British composer who had a big flop of a musical and
It ran
became.
for 13 shows, 14 shows or something.
Yeah, some yeah, fewer than 15 for sure. Flopped in the West End, flopped on Broadway, and is bitter and jaded. He has a twin brother who lives in the UK and does costumes for the National Theatre, who is the polar opposite of him, obviously played by the same actor. And John shows up with a young dancer, Ramon.
Ramon.
Yep. And then there's Buzz, played by Nathan Lane, who is just sort of like the outlier.
Me.
All of us musical theater obsessed. Like
Right.
y'all think I'm musical theater obsessed. I cannot tell you the number of performances Wildcat ran for. Buzz can.
Buzz knows.
Buzz knows. Buzz knows the number of performances of all these
And
shows.
Buzz also has custom shirts made of like bumblebees and other hilarious like one-liners.
Yes. And has musical theater nightmares and dreams, which I do not have.
No, me neither.
His like one of his opening things, he's like, I was having a musical theater nightmare that we're gonna revive The King and I with Tommy Toon and Elaine Stritch.
Which would have been a nightmare.
She, fun fact, Elaine Stritch
Well,
actually
Aline, yeah, I was
did the
gonna
King and I at
say
one point.
Tommy Toon as the king would have been.
I would have paid to see it. I would have paid to see it. It recently came out that the public was in the 90s was gonna try to do a production of Kiss Me Kate with Kevin Kline and Patti LuPone, that was gonna become Kevin Kline and Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio. And Kevin and Patty on paper sound amazing, but I do not think Patty would have been good in Kiss Me Kate at all. It's just one of those things where I'm like, why? And then there was like talk that it might be Mandy Patinkin and Bernadette Peters, and I'm like,
Oh,
why?
wow.
Sometimes people, like, I don't know, bonkers ideas are bonkers until, like, oh, it magically works out, right? You know, like, Tyndalean Gypsy is one of those things where everyone thought, like, why, you must be joking. And then it was wonderful.
Right.
But I think we all can agree, Tommy Tune and Elaine Stritch and The King and I, no bueno. The inciting incident is that...
Is there one more character? No.
No. That's it. Because John and James are the dual roles. The inciting incident is Ramon is the newest member of the crew because he's sort of John's boy of the week. They've only been together for 3 weeks, even though John is clearly infatuated with Ramon, who wouldn't be, he's very attractive. And Ramon is, like, immediately attracted to Bobby. Bobby is very beautiful, of course. And in the middle of the night, Ramon basically, not attacks, they want to make it seem like it was this mutual thing, that they have this connection, but, like, I don't know, Bobby went down to the kitchen to get a glass of milk in the middle of the night, and Ramon was standing there waiting for him. I don't know why he assumed Bobby would come down. I don't know, but he stood there waiting for him. And then basically, like, the two hook up.
Right away.
Yeah. And that's the quote-unquote inciting incident. But the whole play happens, doesn't happen out of order. They start with the inciting incident, and then they flash back to the beginning of the summer. And then we get Memorial Day, 4th of July, Labor Day. Yeah, all of that one summer. And the play also plays around with the fact that while it's happening before us, everyone's also narrating in time and from the future as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, like, direct address to the audience.
Yes. Which is something that I didn't even realize my play connected to with this play.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. At the time when I was writing my play, I was like, this is really Torch Song Trilogy meets Heidi Chronicles with, like, a sprinkling of Significant Other. And then watching this with you today, I was like, oh, and Love, Valor, Compassion. The monologues, for sure. Of people just, like... It's not as consistent, like, whereas Love, Valor, Compassion, like, scenes will be happening and someone will literally come out of the scene to talk to the audience.
Yeah.
And the actors, the characters will interact with each other outside of the scenes with each other. And it's almost as if they are reciting the events of that summer to a stenographer. And they're all kind of, like, correcting each other. Don't say that about yourself. Don't put that on the record. And so that's sort of how it goes. Mine is... I don't know. I haven't necessarily made up the rules of how the fourth wall breaks happen.
It is actually really, yeah, it does feel almost like as if they're speaking to somebody, like, take this down.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was an interesting moment too, where I don't want to give, it's like giving anything away. It's
first of all, the play is 27 years old.
Right.
Which will remind me of that when we get to the epilogue, but 27 years old, and we do spoilers anyway. So.
Well, I was just going to say, like, there's a moment where many of the men in the group come out and they do, like, a dance number together.
Yeah.
And Steven Spinella's character as Perry,
yeah,
starts applauding for them, but the audience didn't start applauding. And so I was like, I wonder if he's going to, and then he immediately just, like, turned to the audience and was like, hello.
Yeah.
Applaud. Like, it was so collaborative in that regard that it was almost as if the audience were, I lingered when I was talking before about the notion of, like, friendship and, like, the show is about. I think it's about friendship because there's two things that happen in the play that I thought were beautiful. One is this direct address to the audience that I just feel that they feel such a closeness to the audience that they can turn to them and they're going to always be on their side. And I found that to be really moving. And the other thing, again, since we're, although I don't want to jump all the way to the end of the play, but there's this thing where, you know, Nathan Lane's character has AIDS.
Yes.
And he is sort of contemplating or hypothesizing about what his future will look like or be like. And he grabs Perry, his oldest friend, and he kind of just grabs his hand and is like, I want you to be there when I go. Mm-hmm. And, like, that just struck me as, you know, my grandmother recently passed away and I learned so much throughout that process of death about the intimacy of it. Mm-hmm. And just about, like, we spoke to, like, there was, like, a hospice was sending, like, a therapist to the house and she was saying to us, you know, you may want to do something, but, like, your loved one may want you to be not in the room when it happens. Like, sometimes people will say they want one thing, but then they don't know what they want. And it just struck me as so, the character of Buzz just struck me as so interesting, again, as beautifully played by Nathan Lane, because it's this character who is such a, like, performer and everything is so heightened and he's always performing. But then the moments of great intimacy were very telling. And I just thought that of all the people that he wanted to be there, it was Perry.
Yeah.
Like, by his side, and asking for that was just such a moment of intimacy that I felt like, wow, this play is about sometimes the bonds of friendship can be
everything. Something that was interesting to me So yeah, the play makes it very clear by the end of the night how everyone knows each other.
Yes.
Perry and Buzz were roommates. They were roommates when Perry meets Arthur. And so Arthur becomes Buzz's friend. And Perry and Arthur meet the same night that Buzz meets John, the British composer who wrote the musical that flopped. And, you know, they always say, like, Perry and Arthur lasted, Buzz and John did not. Mm. But then I also, that makes me wonder then, because they go, oh, John would eventually become our friend Gregory's rehearsal pianist. And I, but they don't say it at the time. They just say, oh, he's Gregory's rehearsal pianist. So you believe at the beginning of the play that they only know John through Gregory. But I think actually Gregory became the rehearsal pianist because of them.
Mm.
Like when his career as a writer stopped going anywhere, like, well, while you work on your next piece, why don't you play piano for our friend Greg? And then when Buzz and John didn't last, John unfortunately still was in their friendship group because of Gregory.
Right.
Which may be a reason why Perry hates John so much. Like, we, you know, we did that asshole a favor and now we can't get rid of him, even though he, like, is no longer dating my best friend.
Right.
Like, why am I...
And he's just, you know, what's the word? James is...
James is the light, John is the dark.
The dark, yeah. Yeah.
And just... they talk about that. But speaking of addressing to the audience and sort of that, like, acknowledging the audience, another thing that they do is Gregory, played by Stephen Bogardus. Is that how you say his name? Bogardus? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Stephen Bogardus, the choreographer... He keeps a journal. He also has a stutter, and he keeps a journal. And John makes it a point to always read the journal because he has no boundaries and he thinks that it's his right. He's like, if I'm going to be out here in the middle of nowhere with you assholes, I'm going to read Gregory's diary. And I think part of Gregory knows that John does it, so probably writes some stuff in there hoping John's going to read it and then it'll sink in.
Mm.
And he talks sort of very candidly about all the friends, not in any negative way, like not in a nasty way, just in a very lightly honest way. And when we get towards the end of the play and John has the diary again, there's sort of like a beat from the audience where they laugh, where it's like, after all we've been through and all the, like, this emotional journey you've gone through, John, like, you're still gonna read the diary. And John Glover just looks out at the audience with a face of like, yeah, of course I'm gonna still read the diary, I'm still me,
right?
And it's like they are reenacting that summer for an audience after having lived through it, as well as, you know, and like coming from a script that they gave a stenographer the year before of, you know, typing it all out, like a group therapy situation.
Yeah.
And then we get to the epilogue where I'm like, well, now we're in time, are we?
Right.
Yeah. But that's, we'll put a pin in her.
Yeah.
So of which character resonated with you the most?
Oof.
Not necessarily one you connected with the most, but one that resonated the most.
Well, Buzz is, like, the obvious answer, just in the sense that, like, I'm actually not very, like, Buzz in real life, aside from the musical theater facts. The one who I feel, like, resonated with me the most in a way that, like, disturbs me is, and I don't have the same amount of vitriol, but I think Perry in some ways.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's Steven Spinella,
mm-hmm.
or if it's the writing. But something about Perry trying to live but can't quite join the others.
Yeah.
I've always sort of inherently felt a little bit in my own life, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely makes sense, yeah.
Again, I don't feel the hatred that sometimes I think his character bottles up and then expounds. But there were moments just tracking through him and how he spoke with the audience that I was like, huh.
Yeah. With Perry, and maybe it is Spinella's performance, but I never truly got, like, hate from Perry. It's clear that he's got a lot of rage in him.
Yeah.
And that's something that most of them have, like, mm-hmm. you see
most of all of us,
all of
sure.
us, yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, why toxic positivity is stupid, because you have, like, those are natural emotions that you have, right? And you got to find a way to release it and acknowledge it, otherwise you're just bottling it up and it comes out in inopportune moments, like the dinner scene in Act One where people just start saying really nasty shit. Perry is very smart and Perry has no patience. And another thing that the play kind of deals with, not fully, but acknowledges, is infidelity in general, because Bobby does cheat on Gregory that one night, and, you know, possibly again.
Yeah.
It's unclear exactly. And eventually tells Gregory, and, you know, they work through it until eventually they don't. And Perry and Arthur had cheated on Perry years ago. The details, unclear. Right. When exactly it happened, unclear. But it happened. He told Perry, and they have worked on it and moved on from it. And Arthur says, you know, like, we're terrific. It's just not the same anymore.
Mm.
And you watch them, and, like, in a weird way, they are great. You know, like, they hold each other's hands. Like,
yeah.
They're there for each other. They're honest, all this stuff. And, you know, Perry isn't punishing Arthur in any way. He never brings it up. But you do sometimes see, like, that there's, like, every now and then, it's sort of like opposite magnets, where it's like they hover around each other, but they don't fully connect.
Yeah.
Which is, I say that as, you know, that's not always the case. They're usually pretty connected.
Yeah.
But every now and then it's that moment where it's like they disassemble, and we're led to believe that that is caused by the affair from how many ever years ago. But with Perry, I always got the idea that he was very smart, very impatient, and probably cynical. And so, like, when they're having that talk at the table,
yeah,
I mean, when I say cynical, I mean, obviously he's cynical, but, like, in part of the combination of it all, because there's a scene towards the end of Act One. It's their first night up in the house, I think, and, you know, it's all going fine, and they're talking about the food and all this other stuff, and the ballet thing that Gregory wants to do for this AIDS benefit. Oh, I'm going to have six men who aren't really dancers dress up in tutus and do the famous Swan Lake dance at Carnegie Hall. And, you know, Perry hates drag. He finds it kind of gross. And he, again, it's the inner homophobia, toxic misogyny of just, yeah, like, I may be gay, but I'm a man, right? Mm-hmm. And I will adhere to
we're trying to hold on to that.
Yes, yeah. The concept of a man is what I'm going to hold on to,
right?
Because, you know, I'm not, I you know, I just got to be this kind of pillar of myself. But they start talking
then, and maybe even the frustration of, like, in his relationship, Arthur is the one who's seen as the butch one, and Arthur, yeah, comments on it, but Arthur is free enough to dress up and participate,
yeah,
in a way that Perry so staunchly expresses reservations.
Arthur's willing to skinny dip. Arthur's willing to put on,
right,
the tutu.
He won't take off all of his clothes. It's, yeah, just half. So I think we've sort of landed on why. Is this your answer too?
Is Perry, my answer? I'm still not entirely sure. I asked you hoping to buy myself time.
Oh.
Because I wasn't...
But it seems like you're also working through... I think the Perry thing surprised me, but, like, the, yeah, more that we unpack it, I'm kind of like, oh boy.
Well, I think, honestly, I am most like Perry. I don't think I'm as angry as Perry.
Me neither.
But I feel like I'm a Perry with a buzz rising. Because,
same.
Yeah. Because overall, I am not of a buzz energy. You know,
no.
There was a time when I was. And I don't know if I've ever really discussed it. It's just, like, we all put on masks, right? Of any kind of...
Sure.
Name. We won't name names. We were talking about the certain bub from my life who, you know, definitely puts on a very specific energy for people that I know in person is not who he is. We all have this. And so I know, remember, like, in high school and in college, it was definitely like the, I'm on. I have the quip here. I have this here. And it's exhausting, and it's fun to kind of live life and be energetic and be the center of attention from time to time. But it is an act. No one is like that all the time. And Nathan Lane does a really good job of sort of
really good that. Job of, yeah.
It's like he's on because when he's not on, he's just violently
correct.
Angry.
And that becomes so clear in the play. He's so good at swiftly, like, turning on it. There's also just, like, let's shout out two things really quickly about Nathan Lane in the show. First of all, the irony of. And I wonder if it was purposeful on uh-huh. behalf of Terrence McNally to give him a shout out as Nathan Lane. Not Nathan Lane. Nathan Detroit.
Oh, and Guys and Dolls?
Sue Me. That's yeah, from Guys and Dolls. And then I think they even talk about Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum for a moment.
Yeah.
Which would be foreshadowing.
Yes.
But, like, just some
yeah,
interesting progressions that I saw.
It's possible. I'm also convinced that he wrote that role for Nathan. Because they had worked together... I'm almost positive they'd worked together at that point. I mean, Nathan had done Guys and Dolls already, yes. And then I feel like, am I making this up? I could have sworn that he and Nathan had done something together and that this was
something he had written for him. I don't know.
But, I have no idea, but if that's the case, it makes utter sense.
Yeah. But with the Perry stuff, I just want to say, like,
yeah.
And so Buzz, you know, obviously the act, and that's like why the Buzz Rising is me, just the musical theater stuff and having that put upon energy sometimes, but I'm not like that all the time.
Right.
Perry can sort of just sort of see the hypocrisy of everything and everyone all the time. And so that the whole dinner table scene, when Buzz is talking about, like, I have this photo on my desk of the starving kid in Africa and the vulture is about to eat him. And Perry just like, Buzz is saying this because he's an empathetic, compassionate person.
Yeah.
And he's like, it sickens me and it motivates me to do stuff. And Perry basically just like, what are you doing though? What are any of us doing? We say we care and we do. We look at the photo and we feel bad. He's like, but then we go on with our white American lives and we don't directly address the issue of that photo. We do not go out there and we don't try to solve hunger in Africa. We don't try to like find the actual cure. Buzz, they have a running, not joke, but like a running theme of Buzz, how is always saying that he's single-handedly going to find the cure for AIDS.
Mm.
But they never talk about what exactly it is he intends to do. It's just sort of his Don Quixote chasing the windmill dream, but unclear what he's actually doing about it.
Well, and I think he works at the clinic.
He works at the clinic, yes, but they never address exactly what that is. He's also a costume designer. He basically has two jobs. He works at the clinic, and who knows if he actually gets paid for it or how much he actually gets paid. And then he does costumes for Gregory's dance company, which I would assume is more his income.
That was actually a part of the thing that broke my heart watching it, though, because like it actually didn't even really. I think Perry is the one who introduces that narrative about like he thinks he's going to change the world with. But it's like I found then that there was a real moment of tenderness between the two of them after like when he said it, because like Nathan doesn't, you know, Buzz doesn't turn to the audience and like, you know, giggle or anything. Like it is a heartfelt moment of like, I do feel that like the work that I'm doing there is more than any of you were doing, and I am going to help. Like, yeah. I found it to be very like,
well, so I bring up the Perry thing just because that I do have that mentality sometimes when I see
performative action.
Yes. When there was that thing in lockdown during when, you know, after George Floyd with the Black Lives Matter movement, like having a major revival, which is great. But so many, there was that trend on Instagram where you would tag 10 people on your stories of like to show that you were against like police brutality or something like that. And it was, the idea was to like show the chain of just how many people in the world actually care and support you. Oh no, that's green one. It doesn't.
I don't remember that one.
I do, because I had two different people tag me, and it was very short lived. It was like a 4-day, blah, blah, and I do not have a major platform in any way, but I did use what little platform I had to be like, hey guys, this is not actually doing anything. It's not addressing any change. This is performative. You were just, you know, showing your small group of people that you care. You're in an echo chamber. It's like, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to donate to these 5 organizations. If you can think of any other ones that are worth donating to, share them. Let me know. Here, I'm like, here are the 5 that I'm donating to. Here are the 5 things that I'm doing. And like, it's not enough. It's never enough. But it's more than just being like, I feel bad. Tag me. Which I think is what Perry is trying to say. But Perry is too bitter and too jaded to actually be like, what can we do? Like what can we do to help? Instead, what he says is like, what are actually any of us really doing? And you get a foreshadow of that earlier at the beginning of the play when everyone's addressing the audience and saying, this happens. And you mention how... when Perry's telling the audience, he's like giving introductions to everybody. He goes, oh, Buzz thinks he's going to single-handedly find the cure. Nathan Lane as Buzz, he's sort of like at the back of the stage and he pops up. He goes, it sounds silly when you say it that way.
Right.
And then Perry goes back to him. He's like, I know, I'm sorry. And like Steven Spinella gives Nathan Lane this like little friendly kiss on the cheek. And that's all you need to see of like what their dynamic is, who they are as people and who they are in their friendship. And like Perry realizes in that moment that he is being cynical about his close friend's dream, and whether it's realistic or not is beside the point. It matters to his friend.
Yes.
And he goes, you know what, you're right, I did say,
I'm glad that registered. It was such a like beautiful moment for me, and it was so early.
It's very early. Well, it's the writing, it's the acting, it's the directing, because you read the script, it doesn't say that that's what Perry does. He just says, I'm pretty sure when you read the script there's not a ton of stage direction.
No.
There's a bit.
There's definitely, I have it here too. I realized I had a PDF on my phone, yeah. But it,
McNally is very weird about what he chooses to be specific about with stage directions and emotions. And some of them I don't think are accurate. Like there's one he has, I can't remember it all. There's one he has that's like, it's not something you can act. It was like something you write in a novel about how a character is feeling. And he just had it in parentheses. I'm like, how do you stage that? How do you act that?
Mm.
And then sometimes he'll be like, oh, this is happening while that's going on. But a lot of times he leaves it up to the actors. Sorry, you were going to say it. Let me find this thing with Buzz and Perry.
No, I'm looking as well. But I,
Oh, no, it is in here. Buzz, it sounds ridiculous when you say it like that. Perry, I know, I'm sorry. He kisses Buzz on the head, goes back to his own bed, picks up a pillow and hugs it close to him. So that is in the stage direction. So I want to apologize to Terrence for that. But the way that they do it on stage, I remember reading it. I did not get that. It did not connect with me in the same way that it did when we watched it, which is also how it should be with plays.
Yeah.
And Terrence says that in his notes. He's like, plays should be watched, not read.
Well, yeah. I mean, that goes back to Joe Mantello for a second, too. But then I saw something in one of my notes that I wanted to just say, but just that, like, the way that this is, and for anybody who hasn't gone to the library and watched it, like, yeah, you should go to Lincoln Center and watch it, because it is so wonderful to read, and it's so fun. Like, I loved reading it in quarantine with, like, a group of friends on Zoom. Like, it was wonderful to hear it.
Yeah.
Because his stuff is so poetic, and it is its own sense of music. It is very musical, and so it makes a lot of sense that music was added, and music is referred to so often.
Mm-hmm.
Which my segue thing, by the way, was, it was just so fascinating to me that they chose to end the second act with Bewitched, Bother to Bewildered.
Yep.
Which, quite literally at its core, is about an affluent woman.
Yeah.
Who is, you know, infatuated with a younger man,
mm-hmm,
and sort of like uses all of these, like, you know, she's showing her intelligence by the words that she's using to describe this affair.
Yeah.
And it just struck me as so interesting, like, here were a lot of these men, again, affluent and like in their country home, and they have beautiful apartments and lives in the city, and they're sort of like singing about, or dance, they were all like waltzing too.
Mm-hmm.
It's just such an interesting visual, and I just feel like Joe Mantello's way that he brought the story to life is so clear that I understand why this is considered like a singular or definitive
production,
because it's almost as if it's like, I can't see it any other way.
Well, two things. This is the second play we've covered that has Bewitched in it.
Oh, that is in the History Boys.
It is in the History Boys.
That's the lesson.
Yeah. Well, fascinating how that song can take on so many different meanings. Because in context of Pal Joey, it's more sexual than it is love.
Yeah.
You know, it's, Vera is not a very lovey-dovey person. She's pretty ice cold. And when she's singing about Joey, it's more like, she's not being like, I'm in love. She's like, it's like, wow, like, sex is fun again. And then it kind of took on a more romantic atmosphere with jazz standards and whatnot, and has a very romantic context in Love, Valor, Compassion, because it ends Act 2 with the dancing, and we have the new couple of Buzz and James, John's right, much nicer brother. And
they also make allusions to Sondheim with A Weekend in the Country, yep, and like they're waltzing like with the dim lights. Like, I feel like all of it is a beautiful homage to so many different,
yeah, there's so many things. Yeah, so many things in there. The third thing with History Boys, it's interesting that Bewitched is used as sort of like a longing, unrequited love. So how one song can take on different facets is great. Regarding this being a definitive production.
Yeah.
So James, when we went to go see this, I told you what the library informed me when I made the reservation,
yeah,
about the viewing of this, which was, what was the restriction?
Which was that we are not allowed to rewind.
Yes,
or fast forward. We are not allowed to fast forward, and we are not allowed to restart it.
Yes. Basically, so the way that Lincoln Center Library works with their videos,
Tuft,
yes. Yeah. Theater of Film and...
yeah, I think it's Theater of Film and Television Archive.
Yes. It is, you know, you get a DVD for each act of whatever it is you're watching. And you, they try to limit you to 3 hours because, you know, if it's busy, they need to have turnover. But, like, I've never been there when it's been really busy. We were there, it was pretty dead. And if we were not watching what we were watching, we probably could have been there for, like, 7 hours and no one would have said boo.
Mm-mm.
And I've done Rewind and I've, like, repeated a disc before. I've spent a solid, like, 5 hours before on a 2 hour piece. So the fact that we could only watch it straight through, no repeating, no whatever, was very interesting. Do you know why that is for this piece in particular?
I feel like you were starting to say it, but I want you to tell me the real, real reason.
I'm going to give you the real, real.
Give me the real, real reason.
Do you remember?
Ooh.
There was a lawsuit from the director choreographer of Urinetown on two different regional productions of Urinetown around like 2006, 2007. Do you recall
that? No.
There became a major, there is now, we've had a major step forward with copywriting of staging in theater, because for the longest time there really wasn't. Like, there were estates that could control certain things, and choreography was always easier to control than other than like direction. But it's why like Jerome Robbins' estate has like all the control of West Side Story's original choreography, Michael Bennett with Chorus Line. That's not the case with a lot of stuff.
Right. But is it the same thing that like when you license a show, for instance, like it has to say like original choreography by Agnes DeMille.
Sometimes.
Oklahoma, or like something.
Sometimes. And but what happened was there was a production, a major regional production of Love, Valor, Compassion that was to the detail.
No.
The original production. Everything. Things that are not in the script. Like, there is no mention of Gregory's dancing in the script. That was something that Joe Mantello added because he thought it was very important to show Gregory's artistic process. Well, like, because there's a lot of describing. People like, Gregory was in the studio doing this while we were doing that. And the way that the set is designed, there's a scrim at the back that you don't realize is a scrim until, I think, the end of Act 1. Mm. When you see Gregory dancing behind it, that's him in the studio.
Right.
And Mantello tried to sue, and I don't think he could, because he didn't have like grounds at the time. But what he was able to do, because how it happened was, the dude went to Lincoln Center Library and just like watched it 9 times and wrote it all down. So I don't know if there is a limit on how many times you can watch this production. I'm sure like in 6 months we could go again. They used to say like you're one and done. I think they might have been lenient on that, but
wow.
You can't sit there and like rewind.
Take notes.
Yeah, like you're watching it and you know whatever notes you take that day are the notes you take. And that's it. And I think I'm convinced that's the reason why that video has that specific restriction.
That's wild.
Isn't it wild?
I know, but it's kind of sad now too, though, because there's so many things. It's not sad because like, I like to watch them, but like, you know, there's so many things that are online.
Yeah.
Just on YouTube now.
Yeah. Well, that restriction was put into place, you know, obviously before bootleg culture came about. And also, bootlegs don't capture everything.
No.
Even the best ones.
They zoom, so, like,
yeah.
You can't get a sense of the picture.
Yeah. There are maybe 10 bootlegs out there that I would consider pretty perfect in the sense that they make sure to capture what's most important and it's not too, like, scuttlebutty. But those tend to come from people involved with the show.
Oh, interesting.
Which I don't like to talk about. Like, there's a bootleg of the Los Angeles production of Ruthless, and it's towards the end of the run. It might even be the final performance. And I'm almost positive it's the director or it's somebody involved on the production team who filmed it, because all the zooms that happen at the exact right moments. There's no like, I get over here and like, they know exactly where to go.
Oh, interesting.
They know exactly where to go.
I just remember like, I feel like I remember, but again, I feel like a dinosaur when I remember YouTube becoming like a thing.
Mm-hmm.
No, in like 2005.
Shoes. Oh my god, Shoes.
But I remember that every day there'd be a new bootleg of Wicked.
Yeah. Also just like a lot of audio, I remember.
That's more what I mean.
Yeah. But yeah, that's what was going on with Love Valor.
That is so interesting.
Isn't
because it's really, it is so not often.
Yeah. The thing, you were talking about this earlier with like the friendship camaraderie.
Mm.
What I like about this play in terms of, and you know, yes, there was a lot of homage and references to stuff, but like the banter of queer friendship. And I know, you know, we don't like to, you know, put an umbrella over each demographic, but I do think that this is true of the queer community. There is a very specific energy and vocabulary to intimate queer friendships, and it's a certain kind of banter, referencing of things, like inside jokes that are like references to movie quotes or theater quotes or whatever. And then there's also like a bit of a jest to things, like almost a slightly like a neg, if that makes sense. The way I describe it is, like, my love language with my friends, and they all know this now, is bitch. I'm a bitch. But only if I really consider you a friend. Because there is the understanding of that safety net, that no matter what I say, you know that I love you. And if I meant any of this, I wouldn't say it. I'm saying it not because it's true, but because it's funny.
Yeah.
It's for the sake of the punchline. And we see this in Angels. We see this in Love, Valor, Compassion. Like, all that stuff at the dinner table when they're fucking with each other and saying, like, you know, bitchy things to each other about the pair, about, oh, you have no hair. And, yes. Oh, yeah. And, oh, you're not the size you say you are. You were pushing 40 when Chorus Line was still on Broadway. Things like that. Like, those are bitchy things to say. But they are with the level of trust of, you know that I love you. And if I actually meant this, we wouldn't be friends.
Yeah.
I'm saying this because I know you well enough to know what your like sore spots are, and I'm going to jab you just enough. It's like, it's the reading challenge of Drag Race. You know, it's like, I'm taking a kernel of truth. I'm expanding it for comedic sake.
Yeah.
And I know it's going to make you laugh because you know I love you.
Well, the other thing too that I guess, to dip back to the old conversation for 2 seconds, is with Buzz.
Yeah.
I think I am actually kind of like him in the sense that so many of my musical theater puns or references go unnoticed.
1,000%. I've had
so like when that happens and he just lets it sit for a second, yeah. I'm always like,
I said to everyone in my life, I have pop culture Tourette's. You do not have to acknowledge what I'm referencing,
but just let it happen.
Let it happen.
Right.
You know,
don't ask who.
Don't ask who. Don't ask what. Don't ask where.
Just let it be.
Let it be. Well, no, you know, everyone goes to the Beatles. I go to Let There Be.
Fierce.
Let there be, let there be. What? Winter.
Water.
Water.
No,
winter.
Rain.
Rain. No. What's the first one he says? Let there be. Morning. Let there be.
Oh, wait, we're singing different songs.
What are you singing?
Oh.
I'm doing Children of Eden.
I went to Once on This Island.
Gross. I go to the show that's never been on Broadway. You went to the show that's been on Broadway twice. You Main Street fuck. God.
Sing it again from Children of Eden.
Let there be morning. Let there be evening day. Let there be. And then there's the stupid children's chorus. They sound beautiful. I just hate children.
Perry. Yeah, I don't know Children of Eden as much as well as I should.
There is... half of that score is gorgeous.
I really like much of the music.
It's also Stephen Schwartz. So some of them lyrics are choice.
Well, it's interesting too. Now we're just...
Who cares?
Yeah.
Now we're just living Love, Valor,
Compassion. We're just living. Right. So maybe that is sort of the best way that we could pay homage to the play.
Yeah. Talking to the mic whore.
Oh, am I hiding from it?
No, you're good.
What I was just going to say about that show is... Stephen Schwartz is, I watched the most incredible interview the other day with him and Janine Tesori. And
okay.
Janine Tesori was talking to him and she was like, she said something that blew my mind open about him. And I was like, whoa. She was like, so many of us composers.
No.
Who write are often not acknowledged or meet the moment that we're in. So many of us write something and then years later people are like, whoa, that was brilliant. She was like, you've struck lightning in a bottle so many times and you've always known how to meet the moment as it's happening. She was like, you did it with Godspell. You did it with Pippin. You did it with Wicked. She was like, you constantly know how to like just match the moment. And I was like, wait. He does. Because, like, if you think about, like, Sondheim, think about early Janine Tesori with, like, Violet, and like, they're not, like, ghetto.
Schwartz, I wouldn't say he always meets the moment. He has three very big moments where that absolutely happens. And that is God's Help Pippin, Wicked. What we are not acknowledging between Pippin and Wicked is the, you know, 30 years in between where he did a lot of great stuff, but not stuff that...
Well, it also turned to film, I guess.
Yeah, but we also have Working. He did the lyrics for Rags. And I would argue that the lyrics for Rags are not great.
I just love Rags.
But Strauss's music is incredible.
Oh my God.
Bum, 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 bum,
it's an amazing bum, show. Ba-da-da.
Is it an amazing show or is it amazing music, James?
To be honest, I don't know how to answer it.
There you go.
Because I did a production of it when I was a child at a community theater. And it is one of my favorite shows I've ever been in. To this day, if somebody was like, what are some of your favorite shows you've ever been in? Rags. Fiorello.
No. Not even Tom Bosley would say that he has a soft spot for Fiorello.
I loved it. These are the shows that I did when
you're
I was
the one.
Kid.
You're the one person who loves Fiorello.
Yeah. I love Fiorello.
Don Draper famously didn't love Fiorello in Mad Men.
In Mad Men?
Yeah. Mad Weiner made it a point
to
say...
Did he prefer to see Sound of Music?
I don't know. That
year?
Who knows what the hell that toxic man wanted. But Mad Weiner made it a point to say on television, Fiorello, what?
I love Fiorello. I'm dead serious. But yeah, this is what I mean, though, about my taste. But it led me to all of this, honestly, like, because I feel like we're nearing, like, James, like, wrap it up.
But no, like, keep going.
No, but like all of it in some way did lead me to love Valor Compassion. And it's interesting that I found this play so much later than so many other things.
Yeah.
Because in a way, it does feel like all of those things that have been bustling around in my head were acknowledged in the play.
Yeah.
Like I had a greater appreciation for this play because of the life that I've lived up until seeing and reading it.
Love, Valor, Compassion is a very solid argument for Write What You Know. Because it does feel like a lot of the things written in there are conversations McNally had with friends.
Sure.
McNally, obviously, of course, had a country home and friends with country homes and all that stuff. And I mean, there's so much optimism in so many of his plays, even when there's anger to it. It's why, like, his, like, big comedies, I don't think are as successful because I just don't think he's... Maybe he is, but his writing just isn't quite sinister enough.
Mm.
For satirical comedies to really bite. Like, he could never write for Veep. He could write for West Wing. I think that's the way I would describe it with him. Even something like Frankie and Johnny, it's all about, like, opening yourself up to love and not allowing passion to pass you by. And even all the cynicism of Love, Valor, Compassion, it's cynicism in the sense of, like, smart people seeing hypocrisy, but none of it felt weighty to me, if that makes sense. They're watching it with you today, I found that the third act, which is definitely meant to sort of be like the serious act, was my least favorite. It felt a little try hard to me. There were a lot of like big monologue moments. John Glover gets his big monologue moment with his twin brother, which I remember saying to you during acts one and two, I was like, there's this little turntable at the front of the stage, they haven't used it yet, and then they use an X3 for like the one moment. I was like, that thing could have been on wheels, it would have been fine. You did not need what they called the lazy Susan. But like John Glover gets his moment, then Nathan Lane gets his moment, Steven Spinella gets like three moments, there's a moment in the canoe with him and John Benjamin Hickey, just like everyone like gets their beat. And the ending, I know, I'm sure it was very moving to a lot of people. It didn't do it for me, especially as we watch more works kind of like satirize these kind of earnest moments. There's the 30 Rock episode where Kelsey Grammer does a one-man version of Abe Lincoln that he's just improvising on the spot to distract everyone while like Jenna and Kenneth do a cover-up. And then they show you the end of the play at the end of the show and as he gets shot in the head, and then he gets shot and he dies. And he stands up and he goes, I'm a ghost now. She's like, and I have one last thing to say as a ghost. And the ending of the play, where they each describe how they go, all I could think of was, I'm a ghost now. And maybe that's because shows like 30 Rock have ruined storytelling but beats like that for me. But also, I'm not sure. It just kind of felt a little out of left field, not super earned. The play's not about... death is mentioned in the sense that Buzz and James, who both have AIDS, are on borrowed time. Like, they are not doing great. James is super not doing great. And, you know, by 1994, 1995, even if it wasn't an immediate death sentence, it was more likely that you would die at some point. But the play was not about death. It was about relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the end of it to then turn into the 6 Feet Under series finale, where it's like they each describe when they go and how they go, I was like, why are we discussing this? It didn't resonate with me. And maybe that's all it is.
No, I actually wanted to just push back on it for 2 seconds.
Please
to
do.
Say that, like, I was thinking that too. But then it was interesting because I took a note on my phone during it. That there's the sense I took at one point, there's a sense that everybody's on a precipice of something. Mm-hmm. And so, like, Perry and Arthur constantly checking in to see, are we okay? Gregory and Bobby, obviously, having their own moment. AIDS, the social unrest, turning the TV, turning CNN, and I'm watching people be brutalized. Like, there's always this sense of, like, are we good? Like, where are we at? What's the thing that's keeping us together? How are we tethered? And so I think that, like, in finding out sort of like what happens post the play, it was a bite-sized way for them to be like, we didn't actually make it as a couple.
Yeah.
Like, we got rid of it. So, like, in a way, because it's not the end of the play, it's not the last thing we see, I feel like it's not as I'm a ghost.
Yeah.
Like, they say it, and then we bleed out of that sort of more abstract sense back into reality. So in that sense, I, like, understood it, but I get what you mean about.
I think I would have liked it more. I liked the Bobby Gregory moment, because, you know, it starts with Perry saying how he's gonna go, and then Arthur says how he goes, and then I think Buzz is after him, Ramon, and then it's Bobby Gregory. I'm almost positive.
I remember that.
Because I'm stupid. My brain is weird. I'm also entirely possibly making this up. I know it that it's Perry Arthur first, because the Perry thing, it threw me, and Perry's like, oh, also, depending on when this play takes place, we could be in the midst of Perry's death.
Oh, because he says
that 27, it's 27 years, 4 months, 8 days, something like that. Or 8 months, 4 days, something like that. So if this is taking place on Labor Day weekend of 1994 or 1995, either Perry has now been dead for 6 months or he's going to die about like 3 months from now of when we record this. So, sorry, Perry, R.I.P. But,
whoa.
Craziness, right? I thought about that when I was like, when is 27 years from this moment?
Whoa.
R.I.P., Perry. And then Arthur 3 years after that. And Buzz is already dead. Ramon is dead.
Is it a plane?
Ramon was in a plane. So, again, it's one of those things where they were given a few details.
But
Ramon...
Like, was the pilot drunk?
What I got from it was that Ramon eventually would have his own company like Gregory and possibly even be successful like Gregory and had the means to fly in a private situation.
Oh.
That is what, like, the company was already where they needed to be. He had to get there, like, in 7 hours.
He, like, pushed.
Yeah, and yes, and got, pushed to get a private plane or something. Just, like, just him and the one pilot. That is what I got out of it.
That would make more sense.
But it's very vague, and there's not a lot of details. But what I bring up the Bobby Gregory thing, because it's less about how Bobby goes, but rather he's like, I don't remember who I'm with or how it happens. And Gregory says, you're not with me. And their conversation is about how they are no longer together and what happens after the fact. Basically, Bobby leaves Gregory for another man,
right.
And Gregory's never with anybody ever again.
Right.
And I appreciated that because... I feel like there's always this kind of stigma on infidelity in dramatic works where it's either like it happens and it's the thing that breaks you up forever and it's terrible, or it's the thing that you work through and you're stronger and it's like true love perseveres. And this play kind of talks about how neither is really true. You can work through it and persevere and you can get to a great place, but it's never the same. Like Arthur and Perry, like they still love each other. It's wonderful. It's great. They're never in doubt, but it's something has shifted. Or it's a Gregory Bobby situation where you do love each other, but the infidelity does come from the root of another issue. And that issue ends up being the May-December dynamic, which, you know, they love each other, but ultimately Gregory was too old for Bobby and it took Bobby 5 years, 6 years to realize it.
Mm.
Not that age differences are a reason to break up, but it was the reason why Bobby broke up.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate that McNally does that with both couples. Of like, we have two couples with infidelity. One makes it, one doesn't. But even the one that makes it, like, they're not, you know, idealistic. They're not, like, better than ever.
Right.
Yeah. Which I, again,
I appreciate that.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Because I think that is actually one of the more realistic elements of relationships in the play. And something that I feel like we as queer people kind of always wrestle with and have to acknowledge. There is... not to toot my own horn, but in my writing, in my play, there is a conversation of sort of how we all, I have a character who does one of the addresses to the audience, and one of the themes of my play is like how we use pop culture as a way to make sense of our lives in the world, because it's, they're all just other people's stories told in a very compact amount of time, and it's like, okay, like, how can I relate what's going on with me to this, like, just to make it make sense? And the character, you know, in a monologue basically says, like, if you're a gay man and you want to have a survival movie guide, it's like, pay attention to the horror franchise, at like at all horror movies, they're the way to get by. Is like, because everybody in this world is just trying to live. Gay men, we have to know how to survive. He's like, so learn when the call is coming from inside the house. Always know that the person trying to get you is going to come back for a second scare. Know that, you know, never take anything at face value, things like that. And part of that also comes with just like understanding like the love you have for someone, the compassion you have for someone, and the valor, the willing to fight for what is right for you, what you need, what you want, and also the courage to know when to walk away when it's not going to be good for you. And a lot of people don't do that. I really don't want to generalize, but it is a lot of straight people, because their lives fit the norm a lot easier than ours does. And so because we're always sort of an outlier, we've had to do a lot of extra work to know what it takes for us to continue standing.
Yeah. And it was so interesting too, that like the two that ended up having the affair are the two who were in a house full of people who are already othered.
Yeah.
They were the two who were even more othered. If you know what I mean.
Yeah. Bobby who is blind. And then Ramon, who is the one person of color.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like, those are the two people that find each other in this house. So in a way, it actually was kind of,
they're also the youngest in the house, right, by far.
Right. There's so many things about it that make it feel kind of like, whoa. But I agree with you, and sort of the treatment of how it all wraps itself up or figures itself out is very interesting.
Yeah. There's always talk about, with Bobby, played by Justin Kirk in this production,
who's fabulous.
He's fabulous. There's also so many Angel connections
right
for this, because you have Joe Mantello, the original Lewis, directing it. Original Pryor, Steven Spinella, is in it. Justin Kirk, who plays Pryor in the HBO miniseries, in it. Nathan Lane, who then goes on to play Roy Cohn in The Revival. Yeah, just so many. So many. And then, I mean, and then Joe Mantello and John Benjamin Hickey do Normal Heart together many years later. It's all incestuous, baby. I love it.
But,
but
they're all so good.
Yeah, but it's a wonderful ensemble.
They're so good.
Spinella, for some reason, didn't transfer to Broadway with it. Anthony Held played Perry. I'm not entirely sure why. But also, Nathan Lane only did the Broadway run for like the first 2 months. I'll mention this as well when we talk about Tony's for a quick second. But with the Bobby Ramon thing, first of all, Ramon is very attractive. And one of the things that the play does and the production does, and it's similar to the second season of White Lotus, in that it is very appreciative of the male form, because a lot of these men have beautiful bodies. And I don't think it's objectifying to say that it is part of the point of it, is that they have these lovely bodies, and it's about enjoying the skin you're in and like loving it, especially at the end when everyone does go skinny dipping in the end, Buzz as well and Perry as well. Everyone goes naked into the lake and enjoys themselves. And there's also the kind of the dynamic between youth and age. You know, everyone's objectifying Ramon because he's 22 and attractive, and they're all getting into their 40s and bodies are starting to fall apart, and Bobby's the only other like young person in the house. There's a lot of talk of how good Bobby is. Like, he's such a nice person. He's just a sweet person, such a caring person. And I think he is. But I also, part of me wonders, you know, there's that sequence in the first act when they all get together for Memorial Day weekend, and every time they're out of the house, Bobby like goes outside for a few minutes and does something that nobody knows what it is. And we see it's basically him like
praying.
praying and like being appreciative to God of everything that he has. He has a boyfriend who loves him. He's got a good life. They're a country home with the friends that they entertain. But Bobby's also 25, probably, maybe 24 even.
I think he's 24, yeah.
Yeah, 20, 24, 25. No older than 24. No older than 25, but, you know, probably around that age, between 23 and 25. And Buzz, probably 38, 39, and that's the next youngest, because then we have Perry and Arthur, who are in their early 40s, Gregory, who's in his early 40s, John, who's in his early 40s. And Bobby likes them all. He gets along with all of them, but Bobby's also living an early 40s, mid 40s life in his early 20s.
Yeah.
And part of me also wonders if, like, that appreciation is sort of like, did you ever watch Crazy Ex-Girlfriend?
No.
God damn it. I'm batting zero with you.
No.
The first episode of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend is basically just Rachel Bloom's character. You know, she's obviously very depressed and whatever, and she's about to be very successful, made partner at her law firm or whatever, and she like has a panic attack when they offer her the position. And she runs outside and she just starts saying to herself, this is what happy feels like. This is what happy feels like. This is what happy feels like. And I don't think it's as like dark as that. But part of me does wonder, when Bobby does those like praying moments to God of the house and all that, if he's like, this is what happy feels like.
Want.
This, yeah, I should be appreciative. I love the man I'm with. He loves me. He's so good to me. He's successful. He has this house we get to come up to that's, you know, wonderful. And we have friends who are smart and successful, who will drive me out to the house. And, you know, this is a good life.
Hmm.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Because that's sort of the thing about cheating, is like, it doesn't come from nowhere. There's something that happens with it. And if you address that, what made the cheating happen, you can work on it and fix it. And that's what ultimately we are led to believe Arthur and Perry did, is that they figured out why it was.
And Arthur, very early in the play, says to Bobby, no one's that hot.
Yeah. It's not
worth it.
Yeah. And Bobby finds out from Arthur that Arthur did cheat on Perry, and asks like, well, how did Perry find out? He's like, well, I told him.
Hmm.
And one wonders if that's like what got Bobby to do it. Cause Bobby tells Gregory a month and a half later,
yeah,
it happens, when they're all back together, and kind of lies to Gregory as well about the circumstances. It takes him that long to tell him, and then he says, well, have you done it again? He says no, unclear if that's even true. And he's like, well, have you wanted to? And he says, no, yeah, I love you.
He
and
definitely,
it's like,
has.
What, we saw him literally go out to the raft and make plans,
yeah,
yeah, to the dock and make plans with Ramon to have sex again
later that night,
yeah, which and he would have done it
if
it weren't for the phone call that his sister died.
Yeah.
And he has to leave for Texas that night.
Paris, Texas.
Paris, Texas.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
True. I mean, true to all. Yeah.
We're very insightful people, James.
Well, this... Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about all of these things. But the other thing is, like, with Bobby, like, I feel like he was also really disappointed when, like, he really didn't want any extra help from anybody. And I feel like that there's a level of it that also may just come from... He has to trust and use his imagination so much.
Yeah.
And it's also heightened around him that I think maybe, in the sense that he's missing one avenue of passion or pleasure, maybe he wanted to seek it elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, when he falls that first time,
right,
on the rake, and everyone comes to help him, he literally says, no one helped me except for Gregory.
Right.
And... It made me wonder sort of like what, and then like Gregory tries to be like heroic and lift him up. And I also love Bobby's like, what are you doing?
Yeah, like, I thought we were headed down another bad path though, when he collapsed and wasn't able to hold him. I was like, oh no.
AIDS.
I hope not everybody is ill.
Yeah. No, that they just foreshadowed.
His body is just, yeah.
Yeah. And what I understand is, you know, first of all, you know, as the years have gone on, we've learned how better to take care of ourselves. So dancers' lives can go on a lot longer.
Yeah.
But I also kind of get the impression that he's someone who, like, when he danced hard.
Hard.
So we're talking about, like, 25 years of, like, hard dancing that is now catching up with him. And he's not slowing himself down, even though he should, which is why his body's, like...
giving up.
Yeah, he's like, it's like, you gotta call it quits now. Which he does in the end. But, yeah, it's... That relationship dynamic is very interesting. And then also, Gregory, you know, he martyrs Bobby so much. You know, you're my angel. He calls him his angel.
Yeah.
You're so good. You're my savior. I love you. Like, I'm so... He says to him, he's like, I know this is a terrible thing to say as you're about to go back to Texas to bury your decapitated sister, but I'm so happy right now. And it's like...
Hey.
And also, that's another toxic trait of, like, wrapping up so much of your happiness and joy in life in your partner. Because they're just another person in this world, baby. And they're just as broken as the rest of us. You should have joy with them. But they should not be
your.
Yeah. They are not your blanket. They are a pillow.
Mm-hmm.
They give you support. They are not your protection.
Right.
That is, oh fuck.
Love that.
Oh my god. I need to write that down on the pillow. Right. Somebody write that down. That's going to my play. Any a partner pillow? Is a pillow, not a blanket. They're your support, not your protection.
Not your protection.
Mother flying fucker.
The blanket is protection.
Yeah. And the pillow is support.
Yeah.
Girl.
And sometimes, if you're like me and you have a bad neck and back, you don't even sleep with a pillow.
What do you sleep with?
Nothing.
You know what comes between James and his bed? Nothing.
No, but, like, isn't that interesting, too, to your analogy?
Yeah.
Because, like, a partner is sometimes, you know, they're sometimes not, but the blanket I always have on.
Hmm. I don't know. I think you're headed down a road of hurt, pain and hurt. A pert.
Hurt. No. God help
me. No, I'm speaking purely symbolically, not realistically.
I hope.
Yeah.
Whatever the. I hope not.
So you just sleep. Well, you can also view the mattress then as your support.
The mattress is the support.
I just don't like referring to people as mattresses.
Right. What's that from?
Golden Girls. Yeah, human mattress.
No. Right. I was like, what is that from?
This is Love, Valor, Compassion. The reference upon reference upon mm-hmm. reference.
And B. Arthur would have liked that.
B. Arthur would have loved it.
And I'm sure she was alive for the
yeah
she?
they were all still alive for this. Estelle Getty was the first to go, and I think she died in 99 2000.
Oh yeah, so yeah. B would have maybe even saw the play.
Maybe she did, who knows. Yeah, I know the exact order. It was Estelle, B, Rue, Betty.
Billy, I beg to differ with you.
How do you mean?
You're the top.
Yeah,
you're an arrow collar. You're the top.
Wait, but also speaking of the Tonys, though.
Yes.
That Nathan did not win.
Nathan was not nominated.
Because he was only with it for 2 months?
So that's what I'm thinking. So, okay, there are two things about the awards of Love, Valor, Compassion yeah. that are interesting. Also, so I also wanted to draw this this article up from the New York Times that I found. The play, when it transferred to Broadway, so it transferred January... Or, yeah, I think previews were January of 95 and then officially opened in early February. So like 2-3 weeks of previews. And then they recouped in April after only 6 weeks. So they were, maybe I have this wrong.
That's wild.
Maybe they started previews end of January, open mid-February, something like that. But yeah, 6 weeks of Broadway performances and they recouped. And this was because of,
Was this the Walter Kerr?
Walter Kerr Theater, yep. Speaking of Angels again, where Angels America premiered, it had a $750,000 capitalization, which, you know, even for that time, relatively small. I think Angels cost like 4 times that amount when it was produced on Broadway. But it's, you know, smallish cast, unit set, and there was a deal made with the Broadway Alliance that allowed it to cost so little and run on such a small amount of money to recoup. Under the Alliance, which was begun in 1990 to save plays from ever-rising costs and ticket prices, virtually everyone involved in a show agrees to caps on fees, salaries, rent, and ticket prices. It applies only to some Broadway houses, mostly those without orchestra pits or otherwise unsuitable for musicals, and also it does not apply to Off-Broadway, which uses mostly non-union labor. There have been 5 shows up until including Love, Valor, Compassion. No. 5 shows before Love, Valor, Compassion that adhered to the Alliance, The Speed of Darkness, Our Country's Good, Crazy He Calls Me, Mixed Emotions, and Any Given Day, all of which were financial flops and was making the Broadway League reconsider the Alliance until Love, Valor, Compassion, which was able to recoup because of that. So basically everyone in the company
made the same salary
or made a lot less. There was a cap, so no one could make it over a certain
amount. It was Favored Nations.
Yeah, I guess it was a Favored Nations contract. I don't know if maybe they changed the name to that, but also Terrence McNally, Joe Mantello, all the designers, but that also applied to the rent. Drew Jampson could not put a rising cost on the rent for them, but not just them, but like, I guess any plays that were going into the Walter Kerr.
Wow.
And then ticket pricing, all this stuff. So everything was done cost-effective, as cost-effective as possible. And it allowed them to recoup in a month and a half.
So this was before Manhattan Theater Club purchased the Samuel Friedman Theater.
Yes.
As their, like, home base.
Yes. Manhattan Theater Club did not have a Broadway house.
Because this was the home of Proof. This was the home of Walter Kerr.
Yeah. Walter Kerr is a commercial Broadway house. Yeah. At that point, the only two nonprofit theater companies that had a Broadway residency was Lincoln Center Theater had the Beaumont.
Right.
And Roundabout had the Criterion. The Criterion, whatever it's called, place that closed up shop in 99 after Little Me. They bought Studio 54
at Cabaret time.
When Cabaret transferred, they bought Studio 54 because they refurbished it to be like the Henry Miller Theater. And then they bought the Henry Miller Theater after Urinetown left.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it was...
And now it's the Sondheim and it's what it is. But yes, Manhattan Theater Club did not have a Broadway house at that point.
Like 97 or so, I think, it came.
I think they bought it later than that. Yeah. They bought it...
Oh, yeah, that has to be later because Lynn Meadow put up Proof at Manhattan Theater Club.
Yeah. Proof was off Broadway and then transferred.
To the Walter Kerr.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, yeah. So
and then I think Doubt was also Manhattan Theater Club.
Mm-hmm.
Same theater. The stage that Love Valor was at. I'm almost positive. Don't quote me on that. We'll know in the actual Doubt episode when we do Doubt. But the other thing with Love Valor Compassion with the awards. So we have the Tonys, which we'll get to in a second. Love Valor Compassion was considered the front runner for the Pulitzer that year. A lot of it was the narrative of Terrence of like, he's back. He's, you know, big career revival, best play he's ever written. It's of the moment. It's a play of the moment. He's, you know, captured the zeitgeist. It's not to like sound like a parody, but it's an AIDS play. And, you know, that was getting a lot of awards these days. And then it didn't win. It wasn't even one of the finalists that year. The three finalists were The Cryptogram by David Mamet, Seven Guitars by August Wilson, and The Young Man from Atlanta by Horton Foote. Now, I know Mamet's a shit, but this was like, he was still in peak Mamet form, so it's not out of the ordinary that he would be a finalist. Wilson, one of the greatest playwrights of all time. And then Young Man from Atlanta by Horton Foote, also one of our great playwrights. So
what won the Pulitzer?
Young Man from Atlanta won.
Oh.
But the article talked about how like a lot of people in the community were very baffled and thought there might have been some agenda behind it. And the committee was, you know, a pretty diverse group for the Pulitzer, critics, playwrights, whatnot. One of them, it was Clive Barnes from The Post, Frank Rich, a couple other people. And they were like basically cornered, like, why didn't you give it to Love, Valor, Compassion? And the Pulitzer has had issues in the past of like not awarding the best play for the Pulitzer. Like, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf famously did not get the Pulitzer, and everyone was like, that's bullshit. But the committee was asked, and they're like, we know, we discussed it. We know everyone brought up the plays that they loved that year, and like two people brought up Love, Valor, Compassion and really championed it, and the rest of us talked about it, and we all kind of realized we all liked it. None of us loved it or valored it or compassioned it. But yeah, there was like, we came up with five plays that we really thought were really exceptional. We narrowed it down to our three finalists, and then we picked the one we thought was the best. Like, that was all it really was to it. And I gotta say, watching it today with you and reading it, like, I get it. Like, I think this is a good play. I think it's not always good, and I don't really think it's Pulitzer worthy. You know, the moments that work best for me are the moments that are not, quote unquote, the important moments. Like, all the soapbox moments don't do it for me. It's the intimate, personal moments that really do it for me. But that's also just my MO.
No, I love those moments.
Yeah. Like, the Perry and Buzz kiss on the forehead moment at the beginning of the play is so much more interesting to me than Buzz's whole, like, oh, funny thing happened away to the farm and nothing happens and it's not funny. I mean, Nathan sells the shit out of it, but I don't love that speech. The other thing with the Tonys, Nathan was petitioned for lead, which I think was a mistake.
Oh.
First of all, this is an ensemble play if ever there was one. And Buzz is definitely the showiest role, but he's not the lead. It's not his story. It's a lot of people's story. He doesn't even get the last word. He doesn't get the first word. He doesn't get the last word. But they put him in lead because I think he was the most famous one at the time.
Hmm.
And Lion King had also come out at this point. I realize, yeah. Even though I don't think like
he was like
it wasn't like Nathan Lane and the Lion King, but you know he makes a joke about it at the Tony Awards that year. He co-hosts the Tonys that year with Glenn Close and Gregory Hines. For the year of Love, Valor, Compassion, yeah. But he was petitioned for lead, and he left the production in like mid-April before the nominations came out. Mario Cantone replaced him.
To do what?
I think to do Birdcage.
Oh.
I think he went off to do Birdcage. And I do think the fact that he wasn't in it anymore and that he wasn't really the lead
took him out of the
running. Took him out of the running, yeah. So the nominees for this were, they were nominated for play and won. Nominated for director.
Did not win.
The big play that year, really, Love, Valor, Compassion was a hit, but like the play that was the play of the moment that season was the revival of The Heiress with Cherry Jones.
Right.
That ran twice as long as Love, Valor, Compassion, made Cherry Jones a star. And they won revival, they won actress, supporting actress, and director for Gerald Gutierrez. And what's funny is I was watching the Tony ceremony. And listeners of the pod who listened to that episode will know, Sarah Jessica Parker presented Best Director of a Play to Gerald Gutierrez, who would go on to direct her 2 years later in Once Upon a Mattress, which was like such a horrible experience for everybody, and everyone blames him for it. So I'm like, oh, that's just like how life works, though, right? Like, who would have thought 2 years later Sarah Jessica Parker would be headlining a production of Once Upon a Mattress, directed by the very guy she gives his first Tony
to? Can we talk about that for 3 seconds?
Sure.
Okay, so I admittedly have never seen an episode of Sex and the City, but I have seen all of them just like that.
Sure.
So I know who Carrie Bradshaw is. I know the world, but I know that it didn't air. I know that it didn't air until...
98,
thank you. This Once Upon a Mattress revival was 96, 7?
It was the winter of 97 and closed, I believe, in June of 90. No, take it back.
So...
Winter of 96 closed in spring of 97.
What am I forgetting or not knowing, aside from Hocus Pocus,
of her career?
What is she like? How do you headline like Sarah Jessica Parker in Once Upon a Mattress and it be so like monumental?
Well, first of all, she had been working since like
she was a kid, right? She
started off as kind of like a teen, early 20s actress, so everyone recognized her. She was sort of like the teenage Catherine Hahn, is the best I want to describe it. Like, was in Footloose. She headlined her own teen movie, Girls Just Want to Have Fun. She got a major boost when she played sort of the sexy character in a Steve Martin film called L.A. Love Story, I think is what it's called. I know. She just worked in a lot of things and became sort of famous by playing major supporting roles in movies that were extremely successful, and then lead roles in movies that were sort of successful.
So by that point, though,
Hocus Pocus was one, but although that flopped, First Wives Club, Mars Attacks, okay. She had a couple of other ones that she was a lead in.
But by that point, it wasn't like today. It's like, no. Sarah Jessica Parker.
No, she also was at that point with Matthew Broderick, and they had sort of become a celebrity couple.
Well, they did.
She replaced Megan Mullally, and then I think she closed out the show with John Stamos.
But at that point, he was a tremendously amount more famous.
More famous than she was. She was decently famous, like she was known, and they got together, and she got more famous by being with him. And I would say that probably also boosted his street cred a bit. It's like, you know, anyone who's famous becomes more famous when they're with someone who's famous. It's just that thing.
But it was like Sex and the City that...
Sex and the City was... She was considered a if not a movie star, a major, major movie actress. Like, she had a career going. So her doing an HBO show was almost considered suicide. No one knew why she was doing it. It was like, oh, are we just blowing up our career now?
Because this was at the time that HBO was still sort of...
HBO was not really big. They had
not doing Sopranos yet, not doing... Yeah.
It was
Six Feet Under.
Yeah, it was pre all that. Even HBO aside,
movie stars weren't doing TV shows.
TV actors wanted to become movie stars. The Friends actors were trying desperately to become movie stars. You were famous and you were rich from doing TV, but you weren't like a respected movie star. And that was always sort of considered elusive for TV actors of making the jump. No one could ever do it. And if you were a movie star who then went into TV, that was considered a major step
suicide.
Back. Yeah.
I see.
It's very different now.
So different now.
So different now. It's now it's like, oh, yeah, you're a movie star, but like, have you done a limited series yet for HBO? Like, that'll right. tell us that you're good.
Right.
Yeah, no, Sex and the City made her an institution. And now she's bigger than he is. But yeah. This is to say, yes, Joe Mantello lost the Tony to Gerald Gutierrez, presented by Sarah Jessica Parker, little would she know a year and a half later, the hell she would go through with him. Three actors for Love, Valor, Compassion were nominated for featured actor.
John Glover,
who won?
Who won, right, okay.
Stephen Bogardus nominated.
Makes sense.
Yeah, and then...
Was Justin Kirk nominated?
No. Anthony Held was nominated, who he played Perry, replacing Steven Spinella. And honestly, I think... The four roles that are the most, like, meaty are Glover's, playing the twins.
Definitely.
Buzz. And Nathan was nominated for the Drama Desk, and I think even won.
Huh.
Yeah. And then so him not being nominated was considered a big shock. But yes, Buzz, the twins, Perry, and then probably Gregory. Just because of the opportunities Gregory has for the physicality of the role.
You don't think Bobby?
I think Bobby is what you bring to it. I think Justin... On the page, I find Bobby to be kind of a wet blanket. I think what Justin Kirk brings to it...
He's fabulous.
He is. And obviously, like, there's material there for him to work with. But I think a role like Buzz is almost actor-proof. You can... Having a great actor doing it makes a world of difference. But Buzz is actor-proof. Perry, you run the risk with a bad actor, a bad direction of just being like, oh god, this asshole again. But he's got good lines. And then with the twins, it's just the very fact that you're playing a dual role, and that's very impressive. Even like, I don't know, even Ramon or Arthur, there's with good actors, as we saw, you can have a lot of great stuff there, but it is up to the actor and director to make that path.
Yeah.
Whereas other roles, it's sort of like just I hate to bring it up again. There was a Tony-winning performance in the last handful of years who won with a big number. And the way I described it was that number is designed to stop the show. It was staged to stop the show. All the actor has to do is ride the train. That performer rode the train well, but that's all you have to do. You just ride the train. And that's kind of like the Buzz and Quinn's role in this play. It's like, just ride the train and you're golden. Everyone else, it's like, the material is there. You kind of have to step up to the plate, though.
Yeah, I see that. I feel like I remember Mary Louise Parker talking about that with Angels in America when she won.
Yeah.
Her, like, Emmy speech or something was like, all of us are just kind of, yeah, like, Tony Kushner and Mike Nichols are brilliant. Yeah. Like, we're just kind of like, thank you.
Yeah. She talked about that in The World Spins Forward book.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like, well, foolproof. She was like, Harper's just brilliant.
Yeah, I think... Was it her who was talking about that monologue? It might have... One of the actresses who played Harper at one point, whether it was Mary Louise or Cynthia Nixon, or I know Deborah Messing did Perestroika at NYU.
Right.
One of them talked about that monologue, and they were like... Because I think it was like... Or maybe it might have been Zoe Kazan. The Night Flight, yeah. Might have even been Zoe Kazan. One of them... Because there was talk about, like, a multitude of them, of, like, how hard it was to crack that monologue. And one of them is like, I found that monologue incredibly easy just because it was so brilliant. I didn't have to do jack shit. Like, it wasn't about me. Harper is an insightful, brilliant mind, messed up and, you know, finding clarity for the first time. But like, that is all it is. Just sitting there and just doing it. And for a lot of those actresses, it was difficult. Like Marsha Gay Harden talked about how, like, she was hiding behind her wig for so long. She wanted that, like, stupid prairie on the farm on the prairie wig. And George C. Wolfe had to, like, wrestle it out of her hands. And he's like, stop hiding and just do it.
Yeah.
And that is kind of, yeah, it's finding the difference between what are you bringing to the table and what are you oversaturating? What are you overseasoning? You know,
they all did such a truly, it was, I'm so glad that we watched it because they brought it to such beautiful and unexpected at times life.
Oh yeah. They found so many nooks and crannies of humor, really realism. Did. It was a lovely job. And I don't know if I ever want to see another version of it again.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty foolproof.
I would love to do a reading of it with you.
Oh, it's so fun.
It'd be so much fun. I did do a reading of Significant Other a few months back, and that was very cathartic.
Really?
Yeah. I need to... Allie Gordon and I would like to do a a reading of Angels at some point, because she has to read Harper and I have to read Lewis. It's got to happen. Especially with recent events, some of the shit that Lewis has gone through, I'm like, I should probably do this out in a play at least once.
Wow. Damn.
Yeah. You know what I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about, but I'm like, damn. I like forgot. Like, there's so much that happens in plays.
In all the plays, yes. But
all the, 6 hours.
Yes. The Lewis Joe Pitt storyline, I'm like, oh yeah, no, I should probably get these emotions out at one point.
Sure.
With a group of friends and have a brilliant writer give me the guide.
Coax you through it.
Yeah. Just ride the train.
Ride the train.
Yep. Speaking of riding the trains, do you think Bobby rode Ramon's train or Ramon rode Bobby's train? Because Justin Kirk is taller than the actor who played Ramon, but I don't know. I feel like Bobby's a bottom.
I don't actually know, because I feel like Ramon loved to, like, advertise.
Yeah. That's something also that I want to sort of discuss. We haven't really talked about many of the characters. We talked about Perry a lot. We talked about Buzz, a little bit of Bobby, and Bobby's relationship with Gregory. But, like, when we talk about the male form in this play...
Oh.
Ramon is definitely the one who's the most objectified.
Sure.
He's the youngest, he's quote-unquote the hottest, and he's the one who is definitely naked the most. Like, his...
Fully naked.
Yeah, when the play begins, not the introduction, but, like, the scenes begin, he comes out naked.
Yeah.
And very comfortable. And I wrote something about sort of, like, there is... Obviously, everyone has their baggage, but I feel like there is a comfort and a confidence that some people get when they have been lucky enough to get physical attributes that many people tell them are pleasing, which is the most PC way I can say when someone is objectively hot. When someone has a body and a face that just, like, for many years are just told, like, you're hot, or it's just the way you're treated. Certain people get treated very differently based on how they look.
Yeah.
And there's a confidence you can get in that of just, like, walking around with your dick out and not caring, especially with everyone in that house. Ramon doesn't really necessarily want to sleep with. So he's not worried about turning anybody on or turning himself on. He's like, they can do what they want. I know they like it. I know everyone likes it. And there's a, I don't know, I feel like I just found a very interesting commentary of that, of the male form, of male confidence, of physical confidence that comes from being objectified, that, I don't know, Ramon at the end of the day is still just kind of a big nothing, you know?
Yeah.
Not a bad person necessarily, but it's all machismo, it's all confidence, all bravado, but he's not much of a thinking man. He is supposedly a very good dancer, but he's and cares about dance, but he doesn't really have a career going. His mind is on the wrong stuff. He should be worrying about his craft and his career, and he's more worried about, like, turning people on and being hot. And I liked that turn at the end of the play where he and Gregory kind of connect in that great way. I did think it was a bit of a hard pivot for Gregory, but whatever. We were wrapping things up at that point. But when Gregory basically says to Ramon, like, join my company, do the solo for the dance that I've spent this entire summer figuring out, that's a turning point for Ramon as well. He can stop just being the young hot
objective
stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And stop being objectified and start doing something.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know. I enjoyed that. I also thought there was something to be said about, like, the costuming of him over the course of the period. Slightly more covered up.
Yes.
Little less.
But still the most fitted.
Yeah, fitted for sure. I mean, he's got a body. He's not going to not show it off. But not always, like, walking around with the swagger of, you want to see me naked. I know you do.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, agreed. And I feel like Arthur, like, worked through it.
Worked through what?
Hit with Bobby.
Gregory.
Okay. Gregory, sorry. I think Gregory and him kind of, like, worked through it.
They did, yeah.
And I think that was sort of his, like, way of kind of being like, okay, like, do you want to be in my piece? And, like, this is how we're going to move through this. I need to at least, like, see you and, like, have you around and know what's going on and I can be okay with this.
I found the moment where Gregory kind of made peace was in the disposal scene. So Gregory finds out at the end of Act 2 that Bobby and Ramon had sex.
Right.
And then we flash forward to Labor Day weekend, which is, you know, a month and a half later,
yeah.
I guess, yeah. And they're all back for Act 3, and Bobby and Gregory are still together, but it's not great. And and Ramon doesn't know that Gregory knows.
Right.
And he's there in the kitchen one morning, dancing and like trying to make light with Gregory, and Gregory's not responding. And then eventually Gregory just grabs his arm and forces him to put his hand in the disposal with the threat of, I'm going to cut your fingers off. Yeah. And Gregory's got Ramon in a very compromising position, a very dangerous position, very violent position. And ultimately Ramon does put his hand in the disposal, but it takes a lot of threatened coaxing. And once he gets him to that brink, he lets go and he's able to sort of release all the toxic anger he had. And
you feel like in that moment, he's expunged of.
Yeah. It almost feels like, I mean, everyone has what they need for closure, I suppose. And for me personally, with the traumas that I have had with people, what has helped me is understanding ultimately who the person I experienced the trauma with is at their core. And the only way to know that is when the chips of life are down, how are they going to act? How they are going to respond? Like, what is that person going to act and their most animalistic urges? Are they going to fight? Are they going to cower? Are they going to be strong and independent? Are they going to be weak? And I think part of Gregory has this feeling of vulnerability of being so much older than Ramon, his body starting to fall apart, and his much younger lover, who he's so obsessed with, had this moment of weakness with a guy he can't even see but could at least tell is, you know, fitter, younger, and makes him feel a bit wounded, and ultimately kind of wanted to see, in this moment of danger, if I were to get Ramon in a moment of vulnerability, would he be stronger than me or weaker than me? Is he ultimately more of a man than I am, for lack of a better term, more of a man than I am, or would he, you know,
surrender?
Yeah. And even though Ramon does put his hand in the disposal, it's not, he acts like it's an act of defiance, but because it takes so much pressure to do it, it is ultimately surrendering to Gregory. I found, especially when Gregory lets him go, and then once he lets him go, that's when Ramon like pumps himself back up and like, I would have popped you one, and blah blah blah. And Gregory doesn't take any of it to heart, and he just goes, would you like some coffee, Ramon? And Ramon's like, go fuck yourself. Yes, please, with milk. And that's all Gregory needed to hear. It's all he needed to see to get his bit of closure of, he's not better than me in any way. It was a moment. He found a way in a moment of vulnerability. He got it. Bobby's still with me, though. And this guy is ultimately no different than I am or better than I am.
I think you're right.
That is what I got from it. And that is also from my own mental instability.
I think you're right. Because it's easier, you know, they say this about like good plays and good players. Like, you'll see it like on stage.
Yeah.
So I think it's more interesting to process that there than like in the intervening time between acts.
Absolutely. And
so it wasn't, you're thinking that it wasn't like a forced smile of like coffee. Like, it really was like a, I have rid myself of this. I've gotten what I need. Would you like your coffee black or do you want?
That is what I got, especially from the way that Stephen Bogart has played it. Because I think you could play it as a whole act thing of like, I'm good, I'm great. But watching Stephen play that scene, I did not get that it was false. I think because of how quick the switch was, it could seem that way. But I didn't get that from him.
Sure.
And maybe I'm misinterpreting. I would love to sit him down and be like, talk to me about that scene. What was going on in your head?
I know, I would love to talk to Stephen Bogart.
You know, I mean, let's talk to that whole company. Let's first, we get Joe in here. We say, Joe, honey, sweetie, boo-boo, child.
There should be like, speaking of like The World Only Spins Forward, I feel like there should be some kind of book about this play.
I would like a book about a lot of the queer plays of the 80s and 90s. And sort of the progression of it, and which ones were able to click and be successful, and which ones weren't, and why. And what that did for writers and actors, like,
And how everybody is so interwoven.
Yeah. So we have someone like John Benjamin Hickey.
Oh, my God.
Didn't really pop until the mid-2000s. He worked. After this, he would do Cabaret with Natasha Richardson and Pitch Perfect, all that stuff. But, like, it wasn't really until Normal Heart in 2011, I think, where he really kind of came back with a vengeance and very open about his homosexuality and has done a lot of work as a gay character.
And then, of course, The Inheritance.
The Inheritance as well, yes. Like, well, and again, that's the representation. There are more stories, there are more roles, and he doesn't always have to just play straight and pass to get work, but that is also kind of his energy. Like, he's a rather masculine feeling gentleman.
Yeah.
But even like Steven Spinella blows up with Angels in America and does this right after. He should have been like a titan of the theater for the rest of the 90s and early 2000s, and that didn't really happen.
No.
He's around and he works, but not to the extent that he should.
Not to the capacity, yeah.
Yeah. Nathan Lane is the one who kind of is blown up in the way that he should have and already was blowing up at that point. But Birdcage got very lucky with how well that movie did and getting to play such a prominent queer role, but then doesn't really play gay much after Birdcage. Plays like very outlandish straight roles like Max Bialystock and Pseudolus and things like that.
Right. I'm missing, I loved Other Desert Cities. I saw Justin Kirk in it. Mm-hmm. Again, somebody I loved him in Weeds. But I'm missing him on stage.
Yeah.
We're seeing things. John Benjamin Hickey's around, though I would love to see him in more.
Absolutely.
Steven Spinella. Steven Bogardus, I think, last thing that I saw him in was...
I saw him at Bright Star, which he was very underused in.
He's the father, right? He's the father?
He plays the adopted father, yeah.
Right.
The one who finds the baby in the bag.
Yes. And then I think I also saw him maybe potentially in The Girl from the North Country at the Public.
Shit, I think he was in that.
I think he's in it at the Public. And then, so I loved him in that. I love him in everything. All of them. And Nathan Lane, how lucky are we get to see a play of his in a few weeks.
I know. That's coming up soon. It's him, Burstein, and Zoe Wanamaker.
Yeah.
Yeah. Directed by Bartlett Sher. What the fuck is that going to be?
And like? Written by Char White, who I love. So I'm actually very like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Lots of cool shiz.
Yeah. I would love a reunion of that cast, one night only, just get it during. And then I don't know. I want to see some reunions of others in that cast doing other things together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who was the actor who played Ramon? He's the only actor that I don't know.
Yeah. His name is Randy Becker. Why does that sound familiar? Let's look up Randy Becker for a second, shall we?
Please. Because he seemed familiar, but I don't know that I've seen him.
Yeah. Oh, apparently during one of the Broadway performances of Love, Valor, Compassion on Broadway, he had an epileptic seizure off stage and his understudy had to finish halfway through. That has nothing to do with his career, though.
Oh, God.
He did do the movie. Nathan Lane was the only one of the original off-Broadway company who did
that. Was that Jason Alexander who did the film?
Yep, which I also have on DVD, by the way.
How's the film?
It's okay. It's realistic. You know, they
don't speak to the camera?
No. I don't recall that they speak to the camera. Jason Alexander has his opening speech to someone on the bus up to the house.
Got it.
Otherwise,
there's no direct address.
Yeah, he's married to Jenna Mattson. They have two children. Okay, so he's straight. He's done some stuff. He was in the movie Sabrina. He played the trainer Sabrina. He was in 4 episodes of the TV show Jack and Jill. He's done some producing.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, he's. He's worked, but he's not. This was definitely like his biggest thing.
And no other plays or musicals.
Let me see what he's done on Broadway. His only thing on Broadway is Love, Valor, Compassion.
I guess that explains why. Because as you know, as a child, I was really only studying theater. I didn't really know what was happening on TV or movies.
And also, like, who's watching the remake of Sabrina with Harrison Ford and being like, who's playing that trainer over there? And that role actually came out, I think the movie came out while Love, Valor, Compassion was on Broadway. So it's not like he got it from the play. Yeah. Yeah, no, he's definitely the only one from the cast who hasn't really kind of gone on in any major way, which is not to undercut his career. But, I mean, he's very good in the play. He's very attractive in the play. Like, I would have expected at the very least a modeling contract. But I mean, that's also the thing is, like, this play didn't, this was not like the cultural touchstone that I think we've been implying that it was. It was big in the theater community for the time that it ran. But this wasn't an Angels where it became national news. This was not a torch song trilogy that ran for 4 years and toured the country. This was a succinctly successful play. Successfully succinct. Like, had a very good off-Broadway run that was able to go immediately to Broadway, where it ran for 7 months, made money, won the Tony, and closed up shop before, you know, it got dire.
Right.
But I don't think ever transferred. I never toured any major regional productions I've never personally heard of.
Me neither.
Yeah.
So we did good work today in our investigation.
I think so. And then it's a solid second for Joe Mantello directs on Broadway again, which is a shame. But now he just can't stop directing, and we're grateful.
So grateful. But I also love watching him act.
He is a brilliant actor.
Yeah, so like, you kind of can't go wrong.
Yeah. Well, honestly, some of the best directors have also been great actors. George C. Wolfe is a wonderful actor and a brilliant writer. Mike Nichols. Have you ever seen any Mike Nichols acting?
No, just the comedy stuff.
I mean, the comedy's great. Him with Elaine May. My God.
Heaven.
Have,
and that's one of the best books I've ever read.
The Mike Nichols biography?
Oh my gosh.
So fucking good. But like, they're both just so natural. She's an amazing actress as well. And those sketches would not work nearly as well as they do if they weren't as good at acting.
The Waverly Gallery, all of it.
She's Waverly Gallery. Jesus, motherfucking titty Christ.
That blew was my that mind.
A brilliant performance. One of the best I've ever seen. It just wasn't acting. But yeah, there's like these directors who... I think the best directors, if not necessarily all great actors, have had experience in one other field besides directing. Have had a foot in writing or acting or design or something like that. Even Hal Prince, you know, producing. So he understood like what it took to get a show together. Anyone who just comes purely from the directing standpoint, I'm like, you become a dictator and you aren't actually collaborative with your writers and you aren't approaching your actors in a way that's helpful to them. Like Jerome Robbins, Michael Bennett, and Bob Fosse. Brilliant men, but also they were not educated and they never really worked as actors. They worked as performers, but not as actors. So you hear all these horror stories about how they got their actors to give them the performances they needed because they did not know how else to ask.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing that I'll say about Joe Mantello too is just that like, but the thing that I was going to say about Joe Mantello too, since this is an episode about him, is
always forever.
I had one of my first, like when I first graduated from college, I had a callback for The Last Ship that he was directing, and I remember it was like at Telsey's old office, and I'm sure he does this to everybody, but it just stood out as something like, wow, this is somebody that I have admired, you know, for so long, like my whole life. And like, he was the first person like next to Bernie Telsey to like get up and like come to the door and like walk across the whole room and like shake your hand and be like, I'm so glad that you were able to come here today. Like, it's so nice to meet you. Thank you. And I was just like, what? But I think, again, it's like, he knows what it is to enter that room and
absolutely
put yourself out there. And I was just so blown away by that generosity and how present he was throughout the entirety of all of it.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm glad that we spoke so much about him, but also I hope that we paid enough homage to the late
Terrence McNally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Terrence was a very good writer. And I think his best work was, honestly, in librettos, but Love, Valor, Compassion is a lovely play. Masterclass is so much fun. All right, we got to wrap things up. James.
Yeah.
We have a game we do now with this series.
Okay.
They are the same game with just two different titles. One is called Who Lives, Who Dies, Janine DeSori. The other is called 6 Degrees of Sally Murphy. They are the same game. It is just 6 degrees of both women.
Okay.
And we have to find 6 degrees from this show to both of these women separately.
Oh.
We can include, so it's cast members of shows. It can be writers, it can be directors too, or designers. We try not to do replacement actors, and you can do like revivals of stuff. But so like, for example,
anybody that was a part of this play.
Yes. Yeah, so like, I'm trying to give an example of like one show we did where it was like, original production of Once Upon a Mattress, Carol Burnett did Putting It Together, which was designed by Bob Crowley, who designed Carousel with Sally Murphy, like that kind of thing.
Jeez.
Yeah. So who do we want to start with first? Janine DeSori, Sally Murphy.
Janine DeSori is actually pretty easy.
Yeah, you think he got one?
Maybe.
Go for it.
We start with Janine.
No, you. We try to find somebody in this show, and then try to connect it to Janine. But you could also work backwards. Start with the cheese and then find your way to the beginning.
Maybe it's actually not as easy and I'm a big mouth.
No, okay. Let's try. Let's pick somebody from Love, Valor, Compassion. Do you want to pick Terrence himself?
But can you, the last question that I have before we do it is, like, can a thing be an institution or no?
What do you mean a thing can be an institution?
Like, can a thing be, like, a person, place, or thing?
Place or thing?
Playwrights or Isaacs or, like,
this. Oh, thing. No.
It can't be an institution. It has to be a person.
Yes. It has to be a person, a show. Yeah, a person, a show. It can't be, like, Playwrights or Isaacs does not count. Unless it was a production of Playwrights Horizons, if a production of that Violet production, someone in that show connected to Love, Valor, Compassion. I'll start with Sally Murphy, because this one's easy and short. Terrence McNally wrote the libretto to Man of the Unicorns.
Yeah, that's
Sally
no fun.
Murphy. There we go.
Yeah, that's no fun.
Okay, Terrence McNally wrote the libretto to Ragtime with Audra McDonald, who's in Carousel with Sally Murphy.
That's more fun.
Sure.
Janine is harder, but I think there's something with the public, but I just have to figure out what it is.
So we've got Fun Home, Carolina Interchange, Violet, Thoroughly Modern Millie. We could also do when she did the vocal and dance arrangements for How to Succeed or for the revival of Sound of Music. We can also talk about how she was the vocal arrangements for Secret Garden and was even the music director of that.
But like, is it, so I feel like I'm doing a terrible job with this, but like, Janine Tesori wrote Carolina Interchange.
Great.
Okay. She collaborated with George C. Wolfe.
Yeah, no, that counts. So what you could say is Steven Spinella. In Angels in America, directed by George C. Wolfe, who directed Carolina Interchange
for Janine Tesori.
Yes.
So I found it.
You just found it, yeah.
Great.
Also, Joe Mantello, Angels in America.
Right.
Yeah, all works out. It's all coming back to me now.
So I did it.
You did it, Joe. We did it, Joe. James, this has been delightful. Where can people find you if you want them to find you?
@James_Crichton.
Amazing. If you want to find me at Matt Koplik, usual spelling, if you like the podcast, give us 5 stars, give us a nice review. Fuck. We have a new review. Shit. I need to give
shout it out.
Yeah, get it credit where it's due. Okay, are we ready? Cue the Light in the Piazza overture music. 5 stars. The big move to another rating. I had left a review for this podcast when it first started, 5 stars then as well, but since the podcast has changed a lot since then, I have decided to edit my review. This podcast is so much fun because it shares so much Broadway history of shows, !, always worth 5 stars, !, love, !, valor, !, compassion, !, bringing it all back together. Thank you so much. James, we got to close this out with some Broadway diva. I just don't know who, and there are no women in this fucking show. So let's do some overlap. There's reference to Judy Holliday, Lucille Ball, Ethel Merman, Barbara Cook, Barbara Streisand, Judy Garland.
I think you need to end with Hey, Look Me Over.
Hey, look me over, lend me an ear.
Yeah. That's what I was or saying. Elaine Stritch singing something from Sail On.
Sail Away.
But you've already used her.
I have done Elaine. We'll do Lucille. We'll do Hey, Look Me Over.
Hey, Look Me Over.
Yeah, it's the first musical number reference in the show.
Yeah.
Hey, Look Me Over. There we go. Done. Join us next week for God Knows What, because this whole thing's being done out of order, and I don't know. It's all a mess. And that's it for now. Have a great week, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, James. Take us away, Lucy. Bye.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage.
and there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.